the appreciation of the panel for counsel's prompt response to our request concerning limitation of arguments. I think it certainly for our purposes will streamline things, and hopefully it will aid you as well and allow you to make the most efficient use of your time. So with that said, I would also add that it is my understanding that Mr. Nager and counsel for the government have both agreed that argument on our question one, the cross-appeal issue, would be reserved for Mr. Nager until his rebuttal, and then the government would respond after that rebuttal. You may proceed, Mr. Nager.
Thank you, Chief Judge Smith. May it please the court. My name is Glenn Nager. I'm counsel for Herbert Vederman, and I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal and for addressing the cross-appeal issue. Thank you, Your Honor. The district court in this case acknowledged that its jury instructions on the bribery-related counts were legally defective under the Supreme Court's decision in the McDonald case. That was prejudicial error. It was prejudicial error because it left the jury to decide a key issue, what is an official act, without meaningful guidance that the Supreme Court has said is necessary, and because it bolstered the government's argument in this case that a corrupt exchange could be inferred from a pattern of official acts that Congressman Fattah allegedly took from Mr. Vederman, when under the McDonald decision, 7 of those 8 acts, in fact, were not official at all.
May we perhaps start with one of the alleged official acts? And I get the impression from your brief, at the timeline on page 54, at least an implication from you that the Zionist hearing, this is a hiring, was indeed an official act.
We recognize that Congressman Fattah challenges whether or not hiring was official.
It was routine.
But we do not contest that issue. We argued the McDonald case on behalf of Governor McDonald. We gave the hiring of a government employee as an example of an act that would constitute an official act.
I just wanted to get that one off the table to allow us to move on.
With regard to our argument here today, with the court's leave, what I'd just like to do is walk through the first 7 and then address why the Zions Act, why there's no evidence to support the proposition that the agreement that Mr. Fattah made with Governor Rendell and Mr. Vederman on Christmas Day 2011 to take Ms. Zions onto his payroll if she needed it to prevent a break in her federal service, where there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that that agreement was done with the understanding that there would be done anything in exchange for that favor that he was doing to his friend Mr. Vederman and his friend Governor Rendell. But let me start.
Before we turn to the facts underlying counts 16 to 18, is count 3 something we can also take off the table? That is, given the idea in both McConnell, when it provides the example of...
Excuse me, this is the Blue Guardian.
Yes.
Matter.
The Blue Guardian matter of a commission authorizing the grant, and REPAC, where we have a congressman who is on the Appropriations Committee making a promise or agreement that a $15 million grant will be given by that very committee. Why don't we have there both the question, the matter, and also the taking of a decision?
Well, Judge Cross, that's a question that Mr. Merenstein was going to address in his time, because it's his client who's affected by that count, and not
Mr. Vederman is not.
Right. No, that Mr. Vederman was not.
And you don't want to take a position on that.
Well, I'll answer any questions that I can about it, but I haven't prepared for it. The court, I understand you have a schedule you want me to adhere to.
Understood. Thank you.
Time is
okay. So, The government in this case did not offer, in contrast to the other counts against the other defendants, the government didn't offer in this case any emails, any documents, any cooperating witnesses to support the proposition that there was a corrupt exchange made between Mr. Viderman and Mr. Fattah, who it was undisputed were friends. Their entire argument was that a corrupt exchange could be inferred because over a 4.5-year time period, and the chart that Chief Judge Smith pointed to, that Congressman Fattah took 8 actions for the benefit of Mr. Viderman. Over that same time period, Mr. Viderman did 6 small favors for the au pair of Mr. Fattah, for the son of Mr. Fattah, and
your characterization of them as small favors, of course, is highly relative and subject to perception.
Strike the word small and just say favors. That was their entire argument was Mr. Viderman does a favor, Mr. Fattah does something. Mr. Viderman does a favor, Mr. Fattah does something. And their argument was, how many of these could be coincidences? That was their argument. And the judge instructed the jury that if it found, it should convict, if it found a course of conduct in which there was an exchange of things of value for a pattern of official acts. But under McDonald, there is no pattern of official acts. The government has admitted on appeal that the meeting that Congressman Fattah set up with the U.S. Trade Representative is not an official act under McDonald. The emails, phone call...
A meeting is not an official act.
Correct.
So are you saying that it's purely the timing of the hiring that takes it out of this sort of speculative official act, that because the meeting, the hiring preceded anything else, that you have to take it out of consideration?
On the hiring issue, we're not contesting that it's an official act. What we're saying is there's no evidence that anything was...
That's a sufficiency argument.
Okay,
let's talk about that. What is the government's evidence with respect to the Zions hiring? Putting aside anything else, don't we at least have, with respect to the Zions hearing, January 18th of 2012, we've got Viderman wiring Fattah $18,000 for the Porsche, right? And on January 19th, the next day, Fattah's staff member sends Zions a letter welcoming her to Fattah's congressional staff. Ain't that something?
Not in the context of the rest of the evidence of this case, Chief Judge Smith, because...
We're talking about sufficiency, we're not talking about weight.
Would that be enough, then? Just the juxtaposition of hiring, the money, and then the official act?
No. There's no doubt, it's not contested in this case, that Mr. Viderman did a favor for Mr. Fattah by agreeing to buy the car. The question is, what's the evidence about why? And the evidence about why is that on January 11th, 2012, Mr. Fattah was notified for the first time that he had a reserve requirement for getting the mortgage on the house that he was trying to purchase, and he called up Mr. Viderman on January 12th and asked Mr. Viderman to purchase the car to help finance the reserve requirement, and Mr. Viderman, as a favor, agreed to. There's no evidence that the earlier discussion between Mr. Viderman, Governor Rendell, and Mr. Fattah had anything to do with this, and it couldn't have, because at the time they wouldn't have even known that this reserve requirement had to be met. The only argument, and the government in this case, remember, their argument was never, we can show you a beyond a reasonable doubt that the car was purchased as a quid pro quo for the hiring of Ms. Zions. Their argument throughout was a pattern of official acts, that one coincidence after another, and the accumulation of them, the sum was greater than the individual parts. That was the basis for which they were arguing.
I understand that, and who knows, that may come back to haunt them with respect to other parts of this case. I'm still trying to figure out, though, with respect to Zions,
why the chronology, the brief chronology I gave you, is not enough.
Because the chronology is that the agreement to take her on was made on December 25th, 2011. January 11th, 2012 comes along, and that's when Kuma notifies Mr. Fattah that he needs the money for a reserve requirement, which he didn't have. January 12th, he calls up Mr. Viederman and asks Mr. Viederman if Mr. Viederman would do him a favor and purchase his wife's car so he could have this money to satisfy this reserve requirement that he didn't know about. And then they go through the transaction with the car. So all we have is the relative timing between the two acts. But indeed, even here, we know that this was a subsequent act. And
I think we've reached a point where maybe we're beating a dead horse on whether or not that's enough. We all know what the facts are, and whether or not it is sufficient circumstantially, the court will have to determine. But am I correct that you're also asking here that recognizing the prospect that if there was McDonnell error here that is prejudicial, that we not remand, that we essentially discharge on those counts implicated?
Our argument on that, Chief Judge Smith, is that the first seven alleged official acts were not official at all. That as a matter of law, they're not official acts because they are constitutionally protected constituent advocacy, which was the very point that the unanimous Supreme Court in McDonald said placed constituent advocacy outside of the realm of the bribery laws to prevent a prosecutorial pall from being cast over. So the only thing that's left at that point
Let's take the ambassador issue is a major issue here. And I understood you to be arguing in your brief that McDonald's advice language is or ought to be restricted to a kind of subordinate-superior relationship. Didn't you say that?
Well, we said that the paradigmatic example of advice would be a superior a subordinate relationship. But the test in the case is use of official position to give advice knowing and intending that another official will have that advice form the basis of their decision. So
what about the letter that is hand-delivered by Congressman Fattah to the President of the United States?
That's not a use of official position. That's a use of political network. That's a use of the trappings of office. There's no sovereign...
If you were a senator on the committee that rules on ambassadorships and the same letter were delivered to the President, would your answer be different?
My answer, if that's all we know and we don't know what's in the letter, my answer would be the same because it would still be constituent advocacy. But that would be a lot, the question of whether or not he was using
the language of Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, following up on Judge Greenaway's question.
So the article...
Advice and consent.
Advice and consent modifies the appointment power, not the nomination power, so that actually the official duties of a senator come after nomination, not before. But as I was just trying to say to Judge Greenaway, it would certainly be possible to have a case of use of official position to pressure if a senator who had the advice and consent power tried to use that pressure. You could also imagine a situation in which the White House agreed with a senator, you give up, you know the people in your district, we will look to you to give us the three people you should consider for an open district court slot. And in that instance, there could be an informal arrangement in which the congressman had been ceded advisory power over a nomination. But there's no evidence of that here. Mr. Fattah was a member of the House. It didn't have the advice.
Yes, but both chambers have their folk ways, right? They have their customs, their folk ways, their ways of doing business. As a member of the House, what if it is customary for a member, perhaps a rank-and-file member of a committee, to rely upon suggestions and advice from the chair of a subcommittee? And the chair of the subcommittee, being fully aware of that relationship, takes a bribe and in return seeks to pressure or argue very persuasively for a particular position. Are you suggesting that that would not constitute pressure?
No, again, if the member is using sovereign official power either to make a decision, to apply pressure, or to give advice, he can't sell the public's power. But what McDonald says is if it's the personal influence and power network of the member of Congress, it's constitutionally protected. We have 435 members of the House, 100 members of the Senate, and as Justice Breyer pointed out very poignantly in oral argument in McDonald, every day they're sending letters on behalf of constituents, and every one of them is soliciting campaign contributions and getting campaign contributions. Mm-hmm. And it would cast a pall over that democratic system
to criminalize that. We got McDonald. Judge Crowley.
Why don't we take from McConnell that the tipping point is a jury question? That is, the court did not say that a letter or a meeting or a phone call counts for nothing. In fact, it said that it is relevant because it may be evidence of advice or pressure. And whether or not there was actually reliance, or even if it were possible for there to be reliance, the court described advice as the actor intending that there be reliance. Given the evidence here, the persistence of the three emails, two letters, the hand delivery meeting, why doesn't that, at a minimum, present a jury question?
I absolutely agree with you. That's why I think that the government's argument in saying that as a matter of law, no reasonable jury could have acquitted here has to be wrong as a matter of law for the very reasons that you just gave. Even under their own standard, those have to be juryable questions. The question that we have added in to what you're asking, Judge Krause, is are there circumstances in which, on the record as you see it, the evidence is not sufficient for a rational jury to find that the government has proved beyond a reasonable doubt that there was a corrupt exchange for an act that is official? And the Supreme Court's decision in McDonnell says, of course, there are all kinds of fact patterns that haven't yet ever been put before the court, and the court's not going to opine them, particularly in a case which involved a governor who wasn't alleged to be giving advice. He was alleged to have taken official acts, and there was a potential that the government might on remand want to claim pressure. It ultimately chose not to do that and dismissed after the remand. But there's no issue in this. We have a record in this case. We know what the facts are. The evidence is, at least in this case, and there's no credible basis for suggesting that Mr. Fattah had any leverage over Senator Casey or over President Obama. He was advocating on behalf of his constituent and friend, Mr. Viderman, and that's not a use of the public's power. That's a use of his own influence. That's constituent advocacy. That's protected. The only official act we have left is the one that Chief Judge Smith pointed to, which is the hiring of Ms. Zients, and I think you understand my argument on that.
Thank you, Mr. Nager. We'll have you back on rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief.
And Mr. Merenstein for Mr. Fattah.
Good morning, Chief Judge Smith. May it please the Court, Bruce Merenstein for Appellant Chaka Fattah. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
It's granted. Let me start at the same point I believe I started with Mr. Nager, because it's a point where there seems, maybe the only point, where there seems to be a little light between your position and his, and that is the Zients hiring. And you have argued in your brief that hiring someone for a routine, part-time, short-term position falls well outside the definition of official act. And I think you suggested that's because it's nothing like lawsuit, agency determination, or committee hearing, even if each shares the happenstance that federal funds will be used. What does something being routine have to do with whether it's an official act. There's nothing in McDonald that suggests that that should be a limitation.
Well, I guess I would respectfully disagree. I mean, the language from McDonald about sort of what the court referred to as workaday functions, like phone calls, setting up meetings, arranging, you know, sending letters, arranging meetings, that said are outstanding.
When judges make routine rulings on an administrative basis and motions all the time, does that make them any less official?
No, but they're still judicial rulings. I think if it's still, if it's a formal exercise of governmental power, which again is a term from McDonald, such as a judicial ruling, and any ruling from a court is certainly going to be a formal exercise of government power.
Suppose the position was chief of staff.
I would still think that that would be within the Supreme Court's definition of a workaday function, but I also would agree it's a lot closer, Your Honor. I think that an appointment to a public position, to an official position, as opposed to hiring a public employee, clearly more of an official act than hiring a part-time, short-term staff person. A chief of staff is going to be somewhere in between, but I think it still is. If it's still hiring an employee of an office, it's a workaday function, it's a routine function that's done all the time.
Hiring of an employee is the grant of an employment contract. Given what we described in REPAC with the facilitating of a contract being sufficient for official act, why is that's true of a business grant contract? Why is there any meaningful difference when we're talking about an official who is facilitating or awarding an employment contract?
I think the difference is that in REPAC you have an authority, the Redevelopment Authority, awarding contracts, government contracts. I mean, that's a formal exercise of government power. And here you have the hiring of an employee, which again is a routine event that happens every day.
I don't get your distinction. And in fact, wouldn't this even be stronger in this case for not being routine? Here, Congressman Fetal had the final word on hiring, didn't he?
I think the record reflects that, yes.
Mr. Repack did not have the final word. He made recommendations to his board, but it required formal board action.
But I think the evidence in Repack, which I think this goes more to the issue that Judge Krause asked before about count three than to the Zion's hiring, is that the record showed, and this court emphasized that the record showed, that Mr. Repack essentially, his role was vital in deciding
the
contract.
Well, it was. One more thing with respect to Zion's. Sure. Since you continue to maintain this as routine, this wasn't a routine hiring, was it? It was over budget. They had to take special steps to be able to take her on because they were over budget for staff, weren't they?
Well, I would not agree with that, Your Honor. There was a letter presented at trial involving the budget and whether or not bringing on a new staff would be over budget. That's all the evidence that was presented on that. There was no evidence presented that it actually put the office over budget. But there's no question, I don't think there's any dispute, that the hiring was intended to be short-term, to do a favor from the Zions, so that she didn't have this break in federal service. But I also am not sure that there's anything McDonald that supports the notion that that it becomes an official act if somehow it's not just the hiring of an employee in a more routine and a regular
occurrence. I'm still trying to work on this routine notion, right? So if I'm a congressperson, I probably have a couple of things that I do during the course of the day other than meet with folks, which obviously we're going to take off the table. I vote on matters, and I hire people, right? I'm elected. Yesterday was election day. I'm elected. What's the first thing I'm going to do? Hire people, right? I need to staff up. That's not routine. That's essential to my function as a congressperson. And when I get to Congress, I vote. I meet with people, I learn about issues, and I vote. Those seem to be the two essential functions of, obviously I'm doing things on behalf of my constituents, but we're putting that aside for a moment. What other formal exercise of governmental power do I engage in? I mean, those seem to be essential.
Yeah, I'm not sure how we can answer the question, Judge Greenaway, without repeating what I've been saying. And I mean, with the court's indulgence, I would like to move on because this is really just one small issue. And I think Mr. Nader has addressed why, even if it is an official act, it doesn't change the analysis. The issue that I would like to focus on, and this was part of our letter to the court in terms of dividing up the argument, is the Juror 12 issue. This court in the Kemp case, consistent with all the other circuit courts that addressed the issue, established a very high standard for a district court to discharge, to dismiss a juror during deliberations. And this court, judges, you're well familiar with that standard that says that a juror can only be dismissed if there is no reasonable possibility.
I was on the Kemp panel.
Yep. And here, I think what the full record shows, which is the two notes, the questioning of the five jurors, the short testimony from the courtroom deputy, I think as a whole, what that shows is there's much more than a reasonable possibility that the difficulties among the jurors and the complaints from the jurors about Juror 12 arose specifically from his skepticism of the government.
Is that so?
Go ahead.
Here's what I don't get about your argument. It's rather extraordinary in a trial setting for a juror to make a statement, as has been attributed to juror number 12, to a courtroom deputy. Because the one thing we know about courtroom deputies, at least in my experience, is they're going to tell the judge what happened. and there's absolutely no reason to think that a courtroom deputy would pontificate, exaggerate in any way. And I know that the juror said, I don't remember putting it exactly that way. But there's no benefit to the courtroom deputy to do anything other than report what happened. Doesn't this put this in, that statement, put this in really an extraordinary category that makes the dismissal appropriate?
I would disagree with a prefatory point.
Disagree with what?
With whether it puts it into an entirely different category. I think that, and I'll address that in a second, but I want to make one thing clear. Both here now on appeal, and the record reflects at the trial court, we didn't dispute the courtroom deputy's testimony. So our
well, and you've got a credibility determination by the district judge, so as between the courtroom deputy and juror number 12.
Hi. And we don't take issue with that. I don't think it's even really necessary because he didn't deny making the statement. When he was asked almost a
full day. We didn't remember making the statement.
Yeah, when he was asked almost a full day later, what he remembered is absolutely consistent with what the courtroom deputy said, is that he remembered that he was complaining to her about his treatment at the hands of the other jurors.
He didn't remember the comment about, I'm going to hang this jury.
Right, because the reason, this gets to your other point, I think the reason, and I don't think he ever, there's no indication that he didn't expect her to tell the judge what he said. I think the reason he reached out and he asked to speak to the courtroom deputy was because he was very upset at how he was being treated and insulted by the other jurors. He was upset, as she put it, at what
was going
on. I'm
not sure how that helps you. Help me with this, Mr. Berenstein, with your argument. Because I read carefully that portion of the transcript and many others, but 18 years as a trial judge, I never had a situation like this. I concede to you it's highly unusual. But your use of something to the effect of the entire record with respect to this is what I have a problem with. When I read that transcript, if we had been only looking at what happened that first occasion, after the first so many hours of deliberation and coming back the next day, if I were in your position, first of all, I would be saying, Judge Bartle should have re-instructed this jury before he went about intruding on the process and asking a question. But on the entire record, what you have then is what happened the next day, in addition to the information coming from the jurors. Doesn't that change the equation considerably, as Judge Greenaway's questions have suggested? This information coming from the court reporter, added to comments from several jurors of, not violent, but physical contact from some jurors about yelling, that whole that whole set of circumstances, why isn't that enough for Judge Bartle to pull the plug as he did?
Well, because first of all, Your Honor, we did object at the trial court and again on appeal to the questioning as opposed to re-instructing the jury. And as you well know, in Kemp, that was what the court did initially, was re-instruct. And in fact, when the court got six separate notes over a couple weeks, three of those times, including the first time, it simply re-instructed the jury. And we had asked the court here to do that, and Judge Bartle did not do that. He immediately after the first two notes came in, questioned five jurors. So we did object to that, and I think that that was a problem. But even aside from that, I think the answer, Your Honor, is in the standard. If you look at the standard, and you look at how it was applied in cases like Brown and Thomas or in this court's decision in Kemp, it's not...
You're talking about any reasonable possibility.
Exactly. The question, in cases like Brown and Thomas, you had jurors who said, I cannot follow the law. I don't believe in this law. But then there was a little bit of evidence that said...
That's why I'm suggesting to you that I would see your argument if we were limited only to that first question or note from the foreman of the juror, along with the follow-up, that first occasion. I could not look at that and say there isn't any reasonable possibility that what was disputed here were merits-related. But when we get into the next day, I don't see how that's not game, set, and match.
Well, because I don't think that what's said in the next day, I mean, I can explain what's said as Juror 12 did, and I think that in the context of the undisputed attacks that he was getting, and it wasn't just him and the courtroom deputy, but it was Juror 3 who said, yes, everybody's getting up on him already. So I think in that context, his statement was something that was said, whether it was in anger or frustration, but even leave that aside. Even if I don't have an excuse for why he said that, I don't think you could just throw away everything that happened the prior day. And
well,
I think
what said was not limited to him, just like the credibility findings were not limited to the deputy. The district judge also made statements that second day and said that he was ruling based on his own observations of Juror 12's demeanor, his behavior, and having observed him during the course of that testimony, and concluding from that not only that he wasn't credible, but that he had preconceived notions about the case, that he was delaying, disrupting, impeding, obstructing the process. Given those findings, doesn't that distinguish this from cases like Thomas, cases where there was found to be a reasonable possibility?
I don't think it does for a couple of reasons. For one, with due respect to the trial court, those findings come out of nowhere. I mean, the notion that he wasn't adhering to his oath, the fact that he had preconceived notions, there's no support for that in the record, including his statement to the courtroom deputy.
There is support in the record for that from several of the jurors who said that he had an obvious bias against the government.
Well, I guess I would disagree, Your Honor. My reading of the record is that in that first note...
You're disagreeing that when they were voir dired, certain of the sitting, deliberating jurors did not say that to the court in camera?
I don't recall them saying that he was biased against the government. That's in the initial...
He appeared to have a bias against the government.
Well,
the record will say what it says.
Precisely. I mean, I think that what the full record, and Chief Judge Smith just made the same point, I think that the full record from that first day, which is the overwhelming record that led to the dismissal, and keep in mind that the government was already strongly advocating for dismissal, and the court was considering dismissal at the end of that first day, even though the bulk of the complaints that first day were about the jurors' vote, which is astounding. None of the other cases have approved a dismissal based on the jurors' vote, based on his reviewing the evidence, based on him spending too much time looking at the evidence and at the court's jury instructions. Those were the core complaints.
When this issue arose, the jury had only been deliberating for a matter of hours, a number of hours the day before, and then the day on which the foreman's question was sent to the judge. Wouldn't your argument with respect to the discharge of the juror be a much stronger one if this had happened days into deliberation, when obviously the jury was grappling to a greater extent after more deliberation, after more discussion, than when they were practically just right out of the jury box?
I would think
it's impossible for the jury to have weighed all the evidence and all the counts at that point.
I think the exact opposite, given the comments from the jurors, Your Honor, from the four jurors that were questioning from the notes. Given that their complaints, almost from the beginning, and the undisputed record is that even that first hour, and the first day of deliberations, they already were upset because Juror 12 would not vote with them. They were already upset and threatening to have him kicked off the jury. They were focusing on the words of the verdict form, which basically just said, do you find Chuck Fatah guilty of bank fraud, as opposed to the jury instructions, which might have three or four pages explaining the elements of those charges. Yeah. So I think that given how early it was, and given that their complaints were, things aren't moving fast enough, he's not voting with us, we show him the evidence and he doesn't agree with us.
They argued that he wasn't engaging in the process. That's part of what they said.
Well,
that he wasn't actively engaging in a discussion, that he was, you know, being obstinate and so forth.
I guess, again, I would disagree. Other than the foreperson, I mean, Juror 6 said, quote, he's participating in the process. I mean, he, you know, Juror 6, she was asked that point blank and said, yes, he absolutely is. The others said, yes, he looks at the evidence very carefully. Their complaints always came back to, he doesn't see the evidence the same way as us, he won't vote with us, he's blocking us from moving on. That's what all of the complaints, that's what that was the focus of the foreman's note that started all this, and that was the focus of all of their complaints. And so, again, with the high standard, I think there's clearly a reasonable possibility that the concern was with his vote, was with his view of the government's evidence.
While you're out of time, could you address here, and perhaps continue if needed on rebuttal, count three and the question that I had asked earlier. Why isn't that clearly an official act, even if we have concerns that are greater as to counts 16 to 18?
I think, the short answer is that the granting of an earmark, which is what is at issue here, would be an official act. But the question here is, Chuck Fatah, Mr. Fatah's role in getting an earmark. And the evidence on that is zero. There's no evidence. The only witness on the whole Blue Guardians issue on this part of it, the earmark, was Mr. Lenufel. He was asked point blank, do you have any experience with the whole earmark process, appropriation process? And he said, no, none at all. And so there's zero evidence in the record. And I think that, you know, there was a hypothetical before about, you
Mr. Lindenfeld testified that Congressman Fatah actually drafted or helped draft the letter that would go to the appropriations.
Absolutely. He helped with the application that would go for the earmark. You know, just like Mr. Silver, in that case, helped draft and shepherd permit requests through. But again, as the court said, you know, there needs to be some evidence, and this is from McDonald, there needs to be some evidence that he and Mr. Fatah could put pressure on the Appropriations Committee or Congress to enact that earmark, or that he had some ability, because of his advice, to get that done. You know, McConnell, so there's no evidence.
The court in McConnell was describing the other uses that could be made of things that would not themselves necessarily rise to the level of a question or matter, but that a combination of things like calls and might give rise to pressure or advice. When it was talking about the exercise of official responsibilities, the court said that it was enough to promise. It was enough to agree. And why don't we have that here, regardless of whether it was something he could, in fact, deliver?
Well, because he has to be, what is promised has to itself be an official act. And so if he's promised to help get an earmark, there has to be some evidence of what his role would be. So if the government had presented evidence that every member of Congress or every member of the Appropriations Committee gets to pick three earmarks every year and they're automatically awarded, that would suffice, I'm sure, to show his influence in getting that earmark.
There's no dispute he's on the Appropriations Committee.
But there's no evidence of what that means. I mean, this is an earmark. Around the same time, there was a lot of turmoil about whether or not earmarks were appropriate, and around this time, they were eliminated. But none of that evidence is in the record, so there's no way to know whether his saying, I'll try to help you get an earmark,
Are you arguing that the record does not support an inference that what was being discussed, an earmark, as they are known, was actually a budgetary item involving the expenditure of public monies for a particular public purpose?
No, I think that what I'm arguing is there's insufficient evidence, there's no evidence of what a congressperson on the Appropriations Committee, here Mr. Fatah, what influence, pressure, ability he has to make an earmark happen.
As Judge Krause asked, essentially, what difference does that make? The McDonnell language is it is enough that the official agree to do so.
Well, the McDonnell language is that it's enough if the official agreed to take official act, and that's exactly what McDonnell says. And so if it's not an official act, if he promised to appoint him to the federal bench, he clearly can't accomplish that. That would not be an official act. And I think that if what he promises to do would not be an official act, right, the promise is not an official act.
All right. Thank you. We'll have you back on rebuttal, Mr. Merenstein. Ms. Flannery.
Thank you, Chief Judge Smith. Good morning, Your Honors. Ann Flannery for Appellant Karen Nicholas. I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. I plan to mainly focus on the RICO count, but I'd like to first address one point pertaining to the juror questioning to follow up on a point, Chief Judge Smith, that Your Honor made in questioning Mr. Merenstein. I would submit that regardless of whether the juror was dismissed, regardless of what he said, or regardless of whether he was credible, launching straight into questioning of jurors 4 hours into deliberations without first taking the non-invasive step of advising the jury to listen to one another and to deliberate with one another had a chilling effect on the deliberations that compromised.
What support in the record is there of that?
Pardon me?
What support in the record exists to suggest a chilling effect, and a chilling effect on whom?
On the jurors, because the record shows that one issue among the jurors was whether to move on to the next count. Another one was whether the individual had committed the crime. Therefore, when certain jurors wrote a note to the judge, and the judge immediately hauled jurors in to question them,
point to something. Any of the interviewed jurors said in response to questions from the court that would demonstrate that somehow the exercise of their deliberative function was being chilled?
It's the fact that they were questioned. Every juror after that knew that if the other jurors wanted to move on to another count and they didn't, or if the others...
Now, wait a minute. Aren't those two different issues? That is, isn't it one issue to say, just as a matter of line drawing, that you just don't do this or take this judicial action this early, as opposed to saying this was done and there was chilling? Seems to me those are two different parts, and maybe the latter isn't even necessary for your argument. But I'm looking for you to show me where in the record the jury has somehow, or jurors, has somehow suggested that their expressions were chilled when I haven't seen it.
Well, with all due respect, I don't think that would be something that a juror would sit there and say to the judge. I think the chilling effect is intrinsic.
Judges rely on jurors in this situation, as well as early on in the initial voir dire, to do exactly that, to speak the truth. The judge's job to make the courtroom a friendly place and an open place and make jurors comfortable so they'll give exactly the kind of candid responses that are necessary for that process. Is there anything that's suggestive of the questions Judge Bartle asked or how he asked the questions that might have chilled jurors?
Yes, Your Honor. He asked them specifically how Juror 12 was deliberating, how Juror 12 was acting. So the jurors that are being asked that question know that if they disagree with the rest of the jury, if they want to move on and the others don't, if they want to vote a different way, then the other jurors can send a note to the judge, and the judge will immediately bring them down and start asking them and asking other jurors, how is so-and-so deliberating? How is so-and-so acting? That implicitly chills
deliberations. So you want us to have a rule that says when a district court intervenes at any time and asks jurors any questions with regard to the process, that is subsequently going to have a chilling effect on the deliberative process? Or are you saying that Judge Bartle did something so extraordinary here that it's apparent and that we need not have a rule like that. We need just to chide just Judge Bartle here? I'm trying to figure out what it is that...
This was an... To some extent, I'm agreeing with the latter description, that this was an extraordinary thing to do. I've looked at every case that either party, any party, has cited in this case in there. With one exception, no case, including Boone, including Kemp, including any other cited from any other circuit, did the judge go straight to questioning a juror, after receiving a note from a third-party juror during deliberations.
You no doubt heard my question earlier with respect to the questioning taking place without any kind of supplemental instruction being
exactly
given to the juror. Are you suggesting that we adopt some supervisory rule that would require, in these extraordinary circumstances, for a trial judge first to give such an instruction to continue deliberating, and the normal instructions that are given to a jury about how to conduct their deliberations before the judge considers the intrusive step of inquiring of deliberating jurors?
Yes, as in extraordinary circumstances that we didn't have here.
How can you do that without looking to what the information is that has come to the district judge's attention? Isn't that why we have an abusive discretion standard? So the trial judge, in the moment, with the information that's been presented and some concern from other jurors, can make that kind of determination.
Yes, but the judge's discretion must encompass the possibility of doing a non-invasive step absent any reason not to. Here there was no reason not to give the non-invasive instruction.
Why can't we look at this record, the entire record, both days of questioning and the answers that were forthcoming, and say that even in the absence of a re-instruction or a supplemental instruction, it's harmless error, because the comments being made by juror number 12, the findings of credibility or lack thereof by Judge Bartle, are all sufficient to demonstrate appropriate reasons to discharge juror number 12.
I would first advocate the chilling effect from the immediate launching into the questions was not harmless here. The information we learned from the invasive questioning about the deliberations gives rise to concerns about the conviction of my client, who appeared to be the subject of the 11-1 vote on the RICO count. Her constitutional right to a unanimous jury was violated by the dismissal so quickly of a juror who was expressing concern about her intent. And that's particularly concerning where evidence of her good faith was excluded on the no accounts. I'm answering your question in the context of my client, and I think the dismissal of the jury had great ramifications for her and should also be considered with respect to the government's argument that the exclusion of that good faith evidence in the no accounts was harmless.
Well, we've only got about 5 minutes left, so let's
If I may address the RICO. Thank you, Your Honor. My client was only implicated in two of the five schemes, the loan repayment scheme in 2008 that the government contended had the purpose of advancing Fatah's political interest, in which the government contended Fatah directed. On the other hand, the other scheme was the NOAA conference scheme 4 years later, which the government concedes was not directed by Fatah. He was not involved in it, and it was not for the purpose of advancing either his political or financial interests.
Well, why wasn't the district court correct that the loan repayment scheme alone, with its predicate acts and with a special verdict form, where the jury was making findings, including as to obstruction, was sufficient to uphold that count and deny the motion for acquittals to your client?
There are five reasons, actually, that holding was erroneous. Three are common to all of the three defendants, and two are specific to my client. The first reason is that the individual scheme does not satisfy the Turquette requirement of an ongoing organization in order to have an association, in fact, enterprise. The government in its briefing has confused acting as a continuing unit, which Turquette describes as a pattern function with ongoing organization, which Turquette describes as a requirement to find an association in fact enterprise. I'm not aware of any case in which a single scheme has been held to satisfy the Turquette requirement of an ongoing organization. It's not logical, and it's not been found. Secondly, the district court relied essentially on the pattern in the loan repayment scheme as being the enterprise. And Turquette is very clear that those are two separate requirements. If joint conduct within a single wire fraud scheme is sufficient to establish an association in fact enterprise, then it would expand the reach of the RICO statute ridiculously. And I would direct Your Honor's attention to the Cianci case. There's a discussion in that, which it's a case the government relies on, a Fourth Circuit case, C-I-A-N-C-I, and it references a Seventh Circuit case, Bachman, that discusses the same thing, you can't broaden finding enterprise within a single wire fraud scheme would unnecessarily and inappropriately broaden the RICO statute. The third reason common to all defendants is that the loan repayment scheme was insufficient to prove a pattern under H.J. There was no continuity. There was no threat of continued criminal activity. The district court, in finding continuity, pointed to the filings, the subsequent filings of the campaign finance reports that wrote down a single fake invoice of Naylor's. But that series of events is quite different conceptually from what H.J. described as events within a single scheme that would give rise to a threat of continued criminal activity.
Well, but there was continued criminal activity here, wasn't there? I mean, really, there were efforts to cut it off, weren't there? Doesn't the activity here necessarily contemplate a need to cover up the loan and what it was for and how it was made?
Yes, but that's part of a single wire fraud scheme. That's not the kind of continued criminal activity that H.J. contemplated when it talked about seriatim victims in a single scheme or new iterations of the same scheme, like in H.J. itself, where it was a rate-making fraud scheme, but each time there was a rate-making hearing that was compromised within the scheme, that was a new iteration of the criminal activity. But covering up a single set of criminal actions, or here the writing down of the CFRs, that was a manifestation of a single decision to write down a single fake invoice. It doesn't have the indicia or the hallmarks of continued criminal activity that H.J. requires us to have to find a pattern.
But we're not talking about just a single instance of filing of campaign finance reports that were false. How do you reconcile your argument with the instruction that was given to the jury that they needed to find at the outset that there had been an agreement to conceal? And we presume the jury followed those instructions.
Is Your Honor addressing count two? Our argument as to count two?
It's as to, and I know you raise it in the context of count two, but I understand it to apply as well to the argument you're making now. That is, that we could somehow separate out and not consider as part of the RICO conspiracy, as part of an ongoing and continuous scheme, the concealment.
The concealment, I'm addressing the pattern requirement and whether the concealment added to the, or prove the requirement that H.J. has of continuing criminal activity with different harms, different victims, or different schemes within a scheme.
So why don't we see that with repeated instances of uses of wire fraud, campaign finance write-downs, drawing of federal funds and other sources as part of that what's described as an overarching scheme for the purpose of enhancing political stature, which required the write-down of those campaigns through false statements and wire fraud.
Yes, because it was all part of a scheme, exactly because it was all part of a single overarching scheme. And therefore, there's not an ongoing organization, as Turquette requires. And even if Your Honor found that the CFRs established continuity under H.J., with which I would disagree, but if Your Honor viewed it differently, focusing on my client, there was absolutely no proof that she agreed to that continuing activity or that it was in any way within the scope of her conspiratorial agreement. The proof, there was absolutely no proof of this, that Ms. Nicholas agreed to or knew of the purpose of the scheme or the enterprise that you just described, that Your Honor just described.
All right, thank you. We'll have you back on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Gross.
Good morning. I would request 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
And I'm Barry Gross, and I represent the appellant Robert Brandt. I'm going to focus on why the government did not produce legally sufficient evidence to convict Mr. Brandt of RICO conspiracy. As a result of this failure, his conviction should be reversed. The government failed in two interlocked ways. They did not provide legally sufficient evidence to show Mr. Brandt participated in the alleged criminal enterprise, and they did not provide legally sufficient evidence to show Mr. Brandt's agreement to conduct the affairs of the enterprise. Both failures hinge on the lack of evidence related to Mr. Brand's awareness and involvement beyond the specific criminal acts found by the jury. Even accepting Brand's conviction in the diversion of funds scheme and the defrauding of EAA in Nassau, that is not enough to tie Brand to the enterprise or the RICO conspiracy. The government charged in the indictment and has argued throughout this case that the activities of the enterprise were organized around what they call five schemes. These schemes also entail the manner and means section of the indictment. The loan repayment scheme is the only scheme Brand was convicted of. He was not charged in any other scheme. And there's no evidence that he was involved in or aware of the other scheme. That one scheme, the diversion of funds and the defrauding of EAA and NASA, is not enough to convict Brand of RICO conspiracy. And even looking and the light most favorable, the evidence in the light most favorable to the government produced against Mr. Brand, there was no evidence of Mr. Brand's involvement or knowledge of or awareness of even the initial loan from Albert Ward. There was no evidence that Mr. Brand knew the source of the $600,000 sent from EAA to Solutions. There was no evidence of any knowledge of what Lindenfeld did with the $600,000 that Solutions for Progress sent him. And there was clearly no knowledge that Brand had that Lindenfeld used that money to pay back a loan that he did not know existed. There was no evidence or involvement or awareness of any campaign finance reports.
All you're doing really is describing a better case, right? It would be a better case if the government had presented evidence of this, evidence of that, evidence of that. But what I'd like to hear is, you know, what is it that we do know, and whether that's enough.
Right.
You know, I think Mr. Lindenfeld was, you know, pretty clear about, you know, what the arrangement was, you know, what the flow of the money was. I think you've talked about, you know, whether if you're involved in a singular scheme, is that enough to be involved in the conspiracy? I mean, I think the law is pretty clear that it could be enough under the appropriate circumstances. So tell me, given what we do have, why that's not enough.
That's not enough. Because there was no evidence ever produced that Brand was aware of
or ever had knowledge of or even agreed to that he was in any agreement and ever agreed with anybody that anyone in the RICO conspiracy would commit two predicate acts. The evidence only showed that he was involved in the movement of the money from EAA to Solutions for Progress, the Lindenfeld, which the jury could find was, and as the indictment charged, was a defrauding of EAA and NASA. There was no element of that.
The movement of the money on two occasions was not two separate predicate acts?
No, because it was all one. It was EAA, the SFP, and then to Lindenfeld. And there were contracts when that money moved initially between EAA and SFP, there was a contract. And when that money moved within, I believe, 48 hours from SFP, the Lindenfeld's company, there was a contract. So these contracts were all at that time. But there was no evidence at all that he was aware of the loan, of the purpose of the money, and there was no evidence at all that he was not.
He knew they didn't do any work.
Well, that was disputed, of course, and at trial. And
well, the COO does, as I recall, the COO doesn't know why the money's going, so he must know something.
Well, the CEO was not.
No, I didn't say CEO. I said COO. He's the CEO.
Right. The COO was not involved in that transaction, but it was clear that Brand, as the owner of the company, had the right and the ability to enter into contracts without the COO's permission.
But there doesn't need to be direct evidence. It's circumstantial right. evidence, and if it's sufficient, would right. be enough to uphold the verdict of the jury, especially with the deferential standard of looking at it post-trial, as the district judge and we are doing. And why aren't there enough circumstances, including reaching out from the outset, offering up to provide consulting with a $600,000 payment, the testimony of Lindenfeld, the fact that the contract was not signed until there was a later investigation, the phone call that is made and the timing and sequence of it to Fatah, and the payments that follow both with the $500,000 and the $100,000, given and that circumstantial evidence as to his knowledge and intent, the list could go on. Why isn't that enough, even if it's not direct evidence?
Because it was not enough. For instance, at the beginning, the contract was for $700,000, the initial contract between EAA and SFP. And the phone calls, all it showed was that there was phone calls between Fatah and Brand. There were numerous phone calls throughout. You know, there was no question that they were friends. There was numerous phone calls. But even that doesn't show that he was tied in to the enterprise. There was no evidence at all, no awareness of all, that he was tied in to
the
scheme.
What about the emails from Lindenfeld to Brand?
I'm sorry?
What about the email from Lindenfeld to Brand? You know, I need to get that money. I'm out.
Yeah, but he never said, I need to get this money. I need this money because of this loan. He said, I made a commitment. Brand has no idea. I mean, that could be anything, what that commitment was.
But Brand knows that they haven't delivered any deliverables to Lindenfeld. When Lindenfeld says that, they know it's not about a business transaction that has emanated from what Brand's business does.
Well, there's two things. One, you know, I believe the veracity of Lindenfeld could be called in question. And as we brief extensively...
That's a credibility issue.
We're not dealing with that now. Yes.
Well, there was no tying. I mean, Lindenfeld never said, even in that email, I have a loan. Even Lindenfeld who I believe was willing to say almost anything, because any time he was crossed, he came back to the government's theory, never said that we ever discussed that loan.
Doesn't the record show that during the course of January 2008, when there were numerous contacts, emails, phone calls made, wasn't Brand the only one who had direct contact with Congressman Fattah?
Wasn't he the only one who had direct contact? I don't know if he was the only one. I mean, he had
these numerous contacts. Well, as far as what the record
there were shows. Telephone calls between the congressman and Bob Brand, but there was no question, as the government discussed throughout, they were friends. There was no context. There was nothing about the context.
Given all the jury had heard about the transaction, the involvement of the congressman in the loan, the intense activity that takes place during January of 2008, why could not there be, as Judge Krause has suggested, why is that not circumstantial evidence from which inferences could be drawn?
Well, Your Honor, even if there's circumstantial evidence about the movement of the money in the scheme, that still doesn't tie him in, Brand, into the enterprise. There was no evidence tying him in to any of these other schemes or anything else.
I don't think there's circumstantial evidence about the movement of the money. I think there's direct evidence of the movement of the money. Right. But the circumstantial evidence is the involvement and role and knowledge of Mr. Brand. But we can hear from you further in rebuttal on that since we've gone beyond the time. Thank you. Having heard from all four of the defendant appellants, we'll hear from Mr. Kravis for the government.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. My name is Jonathan Kravis, and I represent the appellee and cross-appellant, the United States of America. With the Court's permission, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of time for rebuttal on the cross-appeal issue.
Granted.
Beginning on McDonald, the evidence presented at trial that Mr. Viderman paid Mr. Fattah $18,000 in exchange for the hiring of Mr. Viderman's girlfriend to a federal government job. That evidence alone is sufficient to render any error in the jury instructions harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I'd like to begin by addressing the factual record on this, because I think Mr. Viderman's argument about the sufficiency of the timing evidence here is not correct. The evidence at trial showed that on December 23, 2011, the Fattahs received a mortgage application checklist showing that they would have to bring $118,000 to the closing on their Pocono vacation home. On December 26th, 3 days after the Fattahs get that mortgage checklist, Viderman's girlfriend sends Fattah an email through Ms. Bowser with her resume expressing interest in a position. On January 13th, 2012, Mr. Viderman sends the $18,000 wire. And on January 19th, 2012, 6 days after the wire, Ms. Zients receives a letter welcoming her to Fattah's staff. That evidence...
And I referred to some of that in some of my questions.
Yes, Your Honor.
And all of what you have just recited is a recitation of material that is in the record. But let me turn you to what, at least for me, is of considerable interest in these appeals, and that is the ascendancy of McDonald after the convictions in this case. The government is left with that, the court is left with that, the defendants are left with that. And I want to start you with the Kirk issue here, because you've discussed that in the red brief somewhat, the Kirk meeting. Doesn't the redacted indictment cast significant doubt on your argument that the government did not refer to the Kirk meeting at trial in order to establish that the meeting is a separate official act?
I don't think it does, Your Honor. I think that in the government's closing argument, the government never mentioned the Kirk meeting. The Kirk meeting was roughly...
Well, that's your argument, but I'm asking about the indictment.
Your Honor, the indictment, I agree, the indictment does allege the...
Argument is argument. It's not facts, it's not even an allegation of facts.
That's true, but I think if the court looks at, for example, Silver and Skelos, two of the recent post-McDonald decisions from the Second Circuit, what the government argued to the jury in closing is a significant data point that the courts of appeals use to assess the harmlessness of any error with respect to any particular piece of evidence. In both Silver and Skelos, the Second Circuit relied heavily on the particular arguments that the government
made. Mr. Pettis, the redacted indictment, among the various headings in that lengthy document, includes this heading: Fatah's official acts for veteran. And under that, there are three distinct sub-parts, subheadings. One, the pursuit of an ambassadorship. Two, the pursuit of another executive branch position. Three, hiring a lobbyist girlfriend to the congressional staff.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree.
What should we make of that?
Your Honor, I believe that, first of all, the court can consider the indictment and how the indictment framed these charges in light of the government's closing argument to the jury.
But one issue also... in this case, as you know, and which we not are not hearing argument on, is the presence of this document, the indictment, in the jury.
Yes, Your Honor.
For their use.
Yes.
They didn't have a transcript of the government's argument in the jury for their use, right?
That's correct.
They had the indictment. In referring to the Kirk meeting, again, the redacted indictment says this: in or around May 2011, with very little progress made on securing an ambassadorship for veteran, Fatah turned towards obtaining for veteran an appointment in the executive branch.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct, and the government agrees that in light of McDonald, Fatah's efforts to arrange a meeting for Mr. Viderman with Mr. Kirk would not constitute official acts.
Turning towards something suggests that this was another and different act, doesn't it?
It does, Your Honor, but I would point out, not only is there the matter of how the government argued these points to the jury in its closing, and the relatively little time that this actually took up during the trial, there is also the fact that the girlfriend hiring evidence renders any other error harmless, and that is because the jury's verdicts showed that the jury necessarily found that the $18,000 was a bribe payment, and the $18,000, as the evidence of trial showed, and as the government argued to the jury, that $18,000 wasn't connected to the Kirk meeting, it wasn't connected to the ambassadorship evidence, it was connected to one and only one official act.
I want to hear from you further on that, because I want to know what bothers me here is if we were to determine that the Kirk meeting was not, pursuant to McDonald, an official act, why we shouldn't remand?
Your Honor, because the girlfriend hiring evidence establishes an alternative theory of guilt, as the court put it in Andrews.
Isn't the point that a theory is not enough? I mean, we're at a stage, because there's error conceded and we're looking at a question of harmless error, that's a high threshold, and you have the burden on that. And McConnell tells us the jury may have disbelieved testimony to find other evidence that McDonald agreed to exert pressure, but it's also possible the jury convicted on an improper basis. We have exactly that situation here. Even if you were correct that the evidence as to the hiring of the girlfriend is sufficient for a reasonable jury to conclude that there's bribery, that there is an official act.
I agree completely that the standard at this point with respect to the McDonald issue is not whether the evidence was sufficient for a reasonable jury to conclude. The standard is whether the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. However, as this court made clear in Andrews, which is one of the intervening Skillen decisions, where there is an alternative theory of guilt that is supported by the evidence at trial, that alternative theory of guilt can establish beyond a reasonable doubt the harmlessness of any error in the jury instructions. In Andrews, it was a Skillen error. As long as no a reasonable juror would not have convicted on the alternative theory. In Andrews, it was a pecuniary fraud scheme tied in with an honest services fraud scheme, and the Court of Appeals, this court, said that the strong evidence on the pecuniary fraud scheme was enough to render any error in the jury instructions on honest services fraud harmless.
So you would argue that it is not possible here that the jury could have convicted Betterman based on the Kirk meeting alone?
Correct. If the jury had convicted Mr. Veterman based on the Kirk meeting alone, they could not have convicted Mr. Veterman and Mr. Fattah of money laundering and conspiracy to commit money laundering.
What if the jury understood the Kirk meeting to have been a necessary component to an impermissible pattern of official acts? That's the way you tried this case, isn't it?
With respect, Your Honor, I believe it is not, at least with respect to the girlfriend hiring. As the government argued to the jury, the government consistently argued to the jury that the $18,000 bribe payment was in exchange for one and only one official act, the hiring of Mr. Veterman's girlfriend. The government did not argue to the jury that the $18,000 was one more payment that could have been connected to anything. And temporarily, that was the only argument that made sense on the record. The $18,000 came months after the meeting with Mr. Kirk. It came over a year after most of the acts with respect to the ambassadorship. The evidence in the record established a strong temporal connection of that $18,000 payment with one and only one official act, and that is an official act that is indisputably, that I think indisputably satisfies the standard in McDonald. And the jury's verdict showed on both the money laundering charges and also in the conviction of Bowser in the bribery conspiracy that the jury necessarily found that that $18,000 was a bribery payment. There was no evidence that Ms. Bowser was involved in any of the other alleged official acts, and therefore, if the jury believed that the $18,000 was not a bribe payment, the jury could not have convicted Ms. Bowser of bribery conspiracy. And because the jury rendered those two verdicts, this court can conclude that the jury necessarily found that the $18,000 was a bribe payment, and it was connected to one and only one action, the hiring of Mr. Veterman's girlfriend. Mr. Fattah argues that the hiring of Mr. Veterman's girlfriend is not an official act under McDonald, but that argument just finds no support in McDonald itself.
Stepping back, the timing and sequence that you've laid out, again, would support a jury drawing the inference that it was a bribe, and that's what that $18,000 related to. But the jury here was acting under an erroneous instruction. And the defense put forward alternative theories that this was a favor, it was done based on friendship, it was done to help a federal employee so that there was continuity for purposes of benefits and pensions. Given that that's also part of the record with the colorable arguments as to a different purpose in the hiring, aren't we back to uncertainty as to the basis for the jury's verdict?
No, Your Honor, I don't think we are. And the reason is because the question for this court is whether the evidence renders any error in the jury instruction harmless beyond a reasonable doubt on the issue of official act. The only jury instruction error that is being argued here is on the definition of official act in light of McDonald. Mr. Veterman's arguments about friendship, about the lack of a quid pro quo, about an alternative basis for an alternative explanation for the $18,000 payment, the argument that there really was a car sale, all of those arguments were arguments that the jury rejected in its verdict, and those arguments are not implicated by the error in the jury instruction on the definition of official act. The only question for this court at this stage of the proceedings is whether the error in the jury instruction on official act, that one error, in light of McDonald, can be found harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in light of the evidence presented at trial. And here, the jury's verdicts can establish that there was an alternative theory of guilt that the jury necessarily found that was not in any way connected to that instructional error.
Let's turn to the ambassador issue again, where the question of official act looms. You've conceded, as you must, that we're dealing here, all of us, with an erroneous jury instruction. I assume you agree that McDonald has changed the game in these sorts of cases. And you proceeded, the government proceeded with respect to the alleged attempt to secure an ambassadorship for Mr. Bitterman by proving certain acts taken by the congressman on behalf of Bitterman or by the congressman's staff. I think we get three emails, two phone calls, or a phone call and two letters. Isn't it possible now in the wake of McDonald that the jury might have considered those acts as themselves official acts, which we know now in the wake of McDonald would not qualify?
I respectfully sort of disagree with the last part of the question. I do not think it is the case.
Well, they may not be.
Right. So, first of all, as I was saying a moment ago, the hiring of the girlfriend for the $18,000 is an independent theory of guilt from this issue. But turning to this issue, the district court correctly found that wherever the line is between a mere expression of support and advice to another public official, Mr. Fattah crossed it in his repeated recommendations to the White House that the president nominate Mr. Bitterman to an ambassadorship, and that that advice constitutes an official act under McDonald, and that no reasonable juror could have concluded otherwise, even if they had been given a proper instruction on the definition of official act.
How would you suggest we draw this? The line between support and advice then? I mean, you talk in your brief about it being a reasoned recommendation. Is that to say that a letter of recommendation that doesn't go into detail is on one side of the line, and if it does provide detail or talks about any personal experience with a given constituent, that then becomes a potential basis for a bribery charge?
Your Honor, there are several factors in this case that the court can look to into the record to conclude that the district court was correct on this point. One is that Mr. Fattah provided specific reasons in support of his recommendation, and he drew on his personal experience to highlight specific qualities and attributes that he believed Mr. Bitterman possessed that would make him a good ambassador. The second is that Mr. Fattah repeatedly advocated for a particular and specific outcome, a particular and specific official act that he recommended the president take based on the advice he was providing. This is therefore unlike, for example, the evidence.
That sounds like expressing support.
Your Honor, I think that
it doesn't sound like advising. That's the problem I'm having.
I think it is the combination of the specific reasons that Mr. Fattah was providing, the recommendation for a specific outcome, the fact that Mr. Fattah was advocating for this point repeatedly and at repeatedly higher levels within the White House.
If you write a good letter, that's what a good letter sounds like.
Right.
So,
and if Mr. Fattah had written only one letter, for example, that would be a harder case for the government. But here, Mr. Fattah followed up that letter with staff emails, with a phone call, with another letter hand-delivered to the President of the United States.
Let me stop you right there, because I was about to, in a minute, ask you about that letter. This is a narrow question that I'm asking, but it has been a curiosity to me since I started looking at the ambassador issue, what the evidence is to demonstrate that indeed the letter was delivered by the congressman to the president.
There was the email admitted into evidence from Congressman Fattah's aide to the White House. That email,
I know that, as best of my knowledge, there was no objection to that email.
Correct. That email was admitted without objection, and that email stated that Mr. Fattah hand-delivered the letter. In addition, the aide who wrote the letter testified that it was her understanding that Mr. Fattah did, in fact, hand-deliver that letter to the president. Both of those pieces of evidence were admitted without objection.
Yeah, it's been a curiosity to me as to why there wasn't a hearsay objection, because that's a pretty slender read upon which to base a conclusion that the president of the United States received a letter from a congressman. But it is what it is.
Right, and even if the email or the testimony were hearsay, it was not objected to by any party and was therefore fully admitted. And all of that evidence taken together, I don't think it's any one thing here, but all of that evidence taken together, the specific reasons in favor of a specific official action, the repeated urging, the urging at increasingly higher levels of authority, culminating in a letter of recommendation being hand-delivered to the only public official in the world who has the authority to take the official act that Mr. Fatale was recommending. All of those reasons taken together support the district court's conclusion that the wherever the line is between an expression of support and providing advice to another public official, Mr. Fatale crossed it here, and therefore his conduct on the ambassadorship evidence, his conduct with respect to the ambassadorship alone amounted to official act and rendering the jury instruction error harmless. Now, as I said a moment ago,
you have, of course, based your argument almost since taking the podium on the harmless error doctrine. And Mr. Vetterman, in his reply brief, has noted for us that, quote, every court applying the harmless error doctrine test to bribery instructions deficient under McDonald has to date granted relief. Can you give us a case to the contrary?
No, Mr. Vetterman is correct. Now, the Second Circuit did affirm a conviction, notwithstanding McDonald error in the jury instructions in United States versus Boylan, the case we cited in our brief. That error, of course, was reviewed under a different standard, plain error, because the instruction was not preserved. I mean, every court to consider the issue, there's only two of them. There's Silver and Skelos, both Second Circuit opinions, and we maintain that those cases are readily distinguishable from this one. To return to the earlier question about the indictment, in Skelos, for example, the government expressly argued to the jury in its closing that arranging a meeting is an official act. The Skelos court looked to how the government presented the case in its closing argument and said, that's no good, you can't establish harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt. In the Silver case, there was never even a question of whether Mr. Silver had provided advice to another public official. On the mesothelioma scheme, there was just one de minimis official act of introducing the assembly resolution. And on the real estate scheme, there was the key piece that held it all together was the meeting that Mr. Silver arranged with the lobbyists. The Second Circuit concluded that that was not enough to render the error in the jury instruction harmless. In this case, by contrast, we have the alternative theory of guilt, the hiring of the Vetterman's girlfriend in exchange for the $18,000, which was not by any means a de minimis official act. And we have the district court's correct finding that Mr. Fatale provided advice to the White House and that no reasonable juror who was properly instructed could have concluded otherwise. So I guess my very long-winded answer to the court's question is, Mr. Vetterman is correct that the two decisions considering this issue on the harmless error standard have granted relief, not, of course, the relief that Mr. Vetterman requests, but rather a new trial. But those cases are just readily distinguishable on their facts from this one. If I may turn to the issue of the excused juror, the juror's statements to the courtroom deputy clerk that he would hang the jury and it would be 11-1 no matter what were sufficient for this court to conclude that the district court...
Why isn't that merely a statement by a juror of their conviction to make sure that the process works? If you look at the at least the statements of the first couple of jurors that are questioned by the district court, they seem to be, you know, the process is working. He's, you know, got some different ideas, but, you know, we're talking it through. Why isn't a statement to the courtroom deputy merely a reflection of that notion that, you know, they're not going to force me to go the other way because I'm looking at the evidence in a particular way?
Your Honor, it is the statement of hang the jury and 11-1 no matter what. After just a few hours of deliberations, that the district court correctly found did not reflect just a commitment to hold on to the jurors' sincerely held views about the evidence, but rather a refusal to engage in the process of deliberation. Those statements, as the court put it a moment ago, changed the game, and the reason they changed the game is because the whole point of the inquiry that the district court is engaging in here is to figure out the intent and the motive of the juror at issue. And what Kemp and other decisions have recognized is that when the district court has to make that determination based solely on the testimony of other jurors about what's going on in the jury room, that can be a tricky inquiry because it can be difficult for a juror to make the distinction between a refusal to deliberate on the one hand and simply disagreement over the evidence on the other. But in this case, the district court did not have to rely on what other jurors were seeing in the jury room and their account to divine the intent of the juror at issue because the district court had before it the juror's own words.
But the juror's words were not made in isolation. And he also provided the further explanation saying that he was deliberating, that he was doing the best that he could. And as to what he said, I'm explaining, I'm not just going to say guilty because everybody wants me to. And if that hangs this jury, so be it. When we consider the fuller context of Juror 12's own statements, and then the context of what other jurors in the course of the voir dire inquiry disclosed, including, for example, that he was participating and that he was looking carefully at the evidence, how could we say that just 4 hours into deliberations that it was so clear that the grounds for the complaint or disagreement here were jury nullification as opposed to a juror who was sticking by his convictions and was not prepared on whichever count was then on the table under discussion. He was not prepared to give up his own view that the government had not met its burden.
Well, Your Honor, the explanation that the court quoted a moment ago from the juror at issue was one that the district court did not credit, and with good reason. After hearing the testimony of the courtroom deputy clerk, the district court voir dired that juror and asked about those conversations. And in that voir dire, the juror did not mention any statements to the courtroom deputy clerk that it made just a half a day before about hanging the jury. It was only after the juror was specifically questioned about those statements that the juror gave the explanation that Your Honor provided. And when he was asked about the no matter what language, that juror began to backtrack and finally said he couldn't remember what he had said, even though he was testifying about it just a few seconds before. The district court rightly concluded that that juror was not credible and that that explanation of holding on to his convictions was not a credible explanation. And that credibility finding is significant for the reasons that the court articulated in Kemp, which is that the non-credible testimony of the juror at issue is evidence, is further evidence of an improper motive or purpose on the part of that juror. And
the district court did not expressly state that the credibility finding went to that broader explanation. The credibility finding appeared to be, on the one hand, that the statement was made as reported by the deputy, and on the other, finding it was not credible that when Juror 12 said the statement wasn't made or that he couldn't recall saying those exact words. But Juror 12 had at that point acknowledge the substance of it, even if he could remember the exact words.
Well, Your Honor, I think the district court's credibility finding was a little more general than that. I think the district court found Juror 12 in general not to be credible about these events, and having made that credibility finding, the district court was entitled to disregard the statements that Juror 12 had made.
It was a pretty blanket statement determining credibility, as I recall from the transcript. I find my courtroom deputy, whatever her name was, credible, period. I find juror number 12 not credible.
It was indeed, Your Honor, and as this court is well aware, a finder of fact is entitled to take a credibility determination or a determination of non-credibility as casting doubt on the entirety of a witness's testimony, in this case, the juror. That is, the district court was well within its province to conclude that because it had heard non-credible testimony from this juror about whether the statement was made, that that was a sufficient grounds for the court to cast as non-credible the entirety of the juror's testimony about that issue, including the juror's explanation of the hold on to his convictions. I would also point out, to the return to the question from a moment ago, as well as the more recent question, that the district court was not able to say that juror 12 was, when he said, I'm going to hang the jury and it'll be 11-1 no matter what, was not able to get the benefit of an explanation from juror 12 that those specific words, no matter what, and hang the jury, the words that most concerned the district court, that those words merely reflected an intent to hold on to his convictions. And the reason the district court couldn't do that is because juror 12 lied about it. Because juror 12 was not credible in claiming not to remember the statements, the district court could not hear an explanation from juror 12 that he was just caught up in the heat of the moment, or all he meant by no matter what was that he would continue deliberating. That's, of course, not what those words mean in common parlance. But in any event, the speculation that when the juror said he would hang the jury and it would be 11-1 no matter what, that the juror may just have been referring to holding on to his sincerely held views during the course of deliberations was not a decision the court was able to make because the juror himself was non-credibly testifying that he couldn't remember making those statements.
Do I understand correctly from the government's brief that your position is that a lack of candor with the trial court alone is a sufficient basis for dismissal of a juror?
There are cases supporting that view, and I think that is particularly important where the lack of candor goes to the very matter that the district court is investigating. That is, in this case, what the district court was looking at was whether juror 12's statements to the court
were deputy. Yeah, but the lack of candor in this instance would have been a statement that unequivocally I did not say that. That's not what happened here. You could intuit that the equivocation meant something else, like I'm being put upon by 11 people and a federal judge. What's happening?
But Your Honor, it wasn't just equivocation. The juror in the end finally said, "I don't remember making the statements." And the district court.
The district court's entitled to disbelieve a witness who says, after previous questions have been asked and answered, that he doesn't believe the witness doesn't remember. Right?
Correct. And
you were asked about whether the government was taking the position that a lack of candor is enough. We don't have to go there, though, do we?
No, absolutely not.
There's a record in front of us. That's a lack of candor as to what? A lack of candor, maybe an incomplete answer, but the portion of the answer that's been given is, in fact, correct or truthful. We don't need to address that point for purposes of our review, do we?
Of course not, Your Honor. And in fact, as in Kemp, the court can consider the credibility finding as one factor among others justifying the district court's conclusion that the juror at issue was refusing to deliberate.
And the other issues are here allegations of screaming, of yelling, suggestions that juror number 12 had touched the shoulder of one, maybe two other jurors. We have a number of other factors.
That's correct, Your Honor. And with respect to the juror touching another juror, I would just point out that when juror 12 was questioned about that issue, he also claimed not to remember when he was specifically asked by the court about putting his hands on another juror.
And so he did not deny it, however, as I recall.
He did not deny it. What he said was that he may have touched another juror's hands when exchanging the evidence books. And
he actually conceded that it may have happened.
But when specifically questioned about whether he had put his hands on another juror, the juror 12 claimed not to remember, which obviously was significant the next day when the juror again claimed not to remember on a much more significant question, namely his statements to the courtroom deputy that he would hang the jury and it would be 11-1 no matter what after just a few hours of deliberations.
Can we change subject for a moment?
Well, yeah, are you ready to turn to another issue?
Of course.
Okay. So I wanted to talk about the bribery scheme for a moment. In the instructions, the focus was on a pattern of official acts, and I know what you've said about, is it Zions? How do you pronounce it?
Zions.
Zions, right, that's an official act. But since the instruction was on a pattern of official acts, even if we did, as you say, have that as an official act, doesn't that require us to send it back? How is that harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Right, I think it does not, Your Honor. Your Honor is correct that the jury was instructed on a stream of benefits theory of bribery, which amounts to the government can prove these for those instead of this for that. However, within the bribery scheme, the evidence admitted to trial regarding the bribery scheme in this case, there is one official act and one payment that stand together and that stand at the end of the scheme and that are temporarily alone.
Well, I guess my question is, if the jury is instructed on a pattern of official acts and you argue the conspiracy and the conspiracy is argued as a whole,
right,
how is it possible for us to now just sort of pull this one out and think, no, that's harmful beyond reasonable doubt? Harmless
error beyond reasonable doubt. I think the answer, Your Honor, is that the question before the court now, as it sits here today, is not what were all of the legally possible theories that the jury might have accepted, but rather, in light of the evidence in the record, can we say that the error in the jury instruction on official act was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? And in that respect, I think the Zions hiring and the $18,000 is akin to the pecuniary fraud theory in Andrews, such that even if the evidence is bound up together, and even if, for example, in Andrews, the jury was instructed, it's one broad scheme, it's all one scheme with two objects, even if the jury is instructed that it is a larger scheme, the question before the court in light of the intervening decision is, looking at the evidence in the record, the evidence as it came in, is the error harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
So you would have us conclude that the longstanding friendship between Vetterman and Fattah, the fact that Vetterman, along with Zions, socialized when at dinner with the Fattahs, and the possibility that this was a loan among friends and that the car was a way of maybe kind of securing that loan. We should just put that aside. That's not a possibility that would affect in any way the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt equation.
Correct, Your Honor. I think with respect, the jury made that determination when it convicted Mr. Vetterman and Mr. Fattah, and that issue of is it friendship or is it corrupt intent, mm-hmm. that's just not affected by the jury instruction error on official acts. Those are just apples and oranges, better than apples and oranges, they're two different elements of the crime. So the evidence of friendship and a social connection between the two went to the question of corrupt intent. The jury instruction error is on a different element, the element of official act. The jury already concluded that the jury already rejected the sort of friendship defense on the question of corrupt intent, and that issue is not harmless error analysis. That's plain old sufficiency of the evidence. And as the court alluded to in its earlier questioning, there was more than sufficient evidence for the jury to reach that conclusion. The issue before this court on the harmless error review goes solely to the issue of the official act, and the official act instruction just doesn't affect the hiring of the girlfriend because.
So from the government's perspective, Mr. Vetterman's concession that the hiring of Zions was an official act is dispositive of that issue, at least as to Mr. Vetterman. Am I understanding your position?
Yes, Your Honor, and the concession I think is well made because with respect to Mr. Fattah's argument, it is just not a plausible reading of McDonnell to conclude that a particular public official's decision to hire a specific individual to a federal government position is not an official act. It is, I think, unquestionably a decision or action on a particular question or matter. It involves the allocation of federal government resources in the form of
of a salary. It confers the authority and responsibilities that go along with the position, and there is nothing in REPAC or McDonald that suggests that the salary has to be over a certain amount or that the value has to be over a certain amount in order for it to qualify as an official act. When a particular public official enters into a contract, whether it's an employment contract or a contract to purchase materials or resources for the government as part of their official job, they are committing an official act, whether they are buying a jet plane, whether they are hiring a person to a particular job.
Let me ask you this question. We're changing topics again a little bit about RICO now. How does the NOAA conference facilitate or further the purpose of the RICO enterprise, where it does not concern Fatah directly?
Well, as the government alleged and argued to the jury, the general purposes of the enterprise were to advance Fatah's political and financial stature and thereby to benefit the other members of the enterprise. The fake conference scheme had a little bit of a different bend to it in the sense that
It's much later, right? And he's not directly involved, so help me with this one.
It is several years later. Mr. Fatah is not directly involved. The evidence showed that Ms. Nicholas had the opportunity to engage in this fraud because of Mr. Fatah's help in lining up NOAA as a possible sponsor of the conference. But as the court recognized in the HJ case, mentioned by the defendants in their argument, predicate acts can fit a pattern of racketeering activity if they have, quote, similar purposes, results, participants, victims, or methods of commission. Here, the fake conference scheme had similar purposes and results to the other predicate acts that were charged in the RICO conspiracy. In particular, it involved the misappropriation of funds, often federal government funds, to achieve a financial benefit to the conspirators through acts of wire fraud. And it wasn't just Nicholas. Mr. Naylor also received proceeds of the fake conference scheme. Mr. Naylor was involved in both the loan repayment schemes and the college tuition scheme.
So you're saying the connection of Fatah to essentially set up the opportunity for the conference is a sufficient nexus to say that this is part of the overall RICO?
It doesn't all have to be connected to Fatah. Fatah, of course, was the common thread in the other schemes, and Fatah makes an appearance in the big conference.
But without what I've just said, I'm not seeing a nexus, right, at all, right? Because it sounds like either a separate scheme or a separate fraud. How does it go? The overall purpose you talk about is, you don't say aggrandizement, but I can't think of another word at the moment, of Fatah, his reputation, and stay in power, et cetera, et cetera. So how is this going towards that particular goal, as you all have said?
Well, the purpose of the RICO conspiracy, as it was alleged in the indictment and argued to the jury, involved advancing not just Fatah's interests, but also the interests of the other members of the conspiracy. And here, the fake conference scheme is advancing the interests of Nicholas and Naylor, and they're using similar methods as in to the other schemes. They're using similar methods of commission. They're using EAA again. EAA, which appears in the loan repayment scheme, the Fatah Conference on Higher Education, which also appears in the loan repayment scheme. They're using fake records and misrepresentations to misappropriate federal government funds. These are all factors that the court in HJ said are relevant to the question of whether particular actions fall within the pattern. I would also note that the evidence, as the district court correctly found, the evidence of Ms. Nicholas's participation in the loan repayment scheme alone was sufficient to support her conviction for racketeering conspiracy. So even if the court were to conclude that the fake conference scheme was too attenuated or falls outside of the RICO conspiracy, the evidence of Ms. Nicholas's participation, her personal commitment of multiple acts of obstruction of justice and wire fraud in the loan repayment scheme, that alone is sufficient to support her conviction for RICO conspiracy. Now, Ms. Nicholas and Mr. Brand both make essentially the same argument about this count. They say the evidence wasn't sufficient to show that we knew enough to put us in the racketeering conspiracy. But the evidence at trial was more than sufficient for the jury to conclude, as it did, that Ms. Nicholas and Mr. Brand were aware of the larger purposes of their racketeering activity, both the racketeering activity that they committed and the racketeering activity that they helped each other commit, the obstruction of justice, to serve the larger purpose of the enterprise conspiracy of advancing Fatah's political and financial interests through corrupt means. With respect to Mr. Brand, he's right in the middle of all of the transactions. He is the one who is getting the money from EAA and then passing it along to Solutions for Progress. Mr. Lindenfeld testified that Mr. Brand called him out of the blue and proposed a contract that had Mr. Brand's company sending Mr. Lindenfeld the exact amount of money that is needed to repay the illegal campaign loan. Then Mr. Lindenfeld says he calls Fatah and tells him, I got this offer from Brand, I'm going to use the money to repay the loan. And Fatah says, do it. Then you have the emails between Brand and Lindenfeld, referenced a moment ago in Your Honor's question, where Lindenfeld is saying, please don't drag this out, I've made a commitment based on yours to me. And as Mr. Lindenfeld testified, this referred to the use of Mr. Brand's money to repay the Lord loan. You also have the telephone records showing numerous phone calls between Mr. Brand and Mr. Fatah during this time period. You also had Mr. Lindenfeld's testimony that in a meeting he calls out Mr. Brand about the money. That Mr. Brand, they're in a meeting at Solutions, and Mr. Brand says, we'd like you to do some work for us for the money we gave you, or someone else in the meeting says it, and Mr. Lindenfeld says, we're happy to do the work, but not for that money. That money was for Fatah. And Brand calls him out of the meeting and says, you can't say that in front of other people. That was Mr. Lindenfeld's testimony about what Mr. Brand knew here. Finally, there is the sheer implausibility of the contrary inference. The evidence at trial showed that Ms. Nicholas is defrauding her own nonprofit to the tune of $600,000. The evidence showed that Mr. Brand is taking the EAA money, adding some of his own money, and sending it across to Mr. Lindenfeld within days, at a time when both Mr. Brand's company and Ms. Nicholas's nonprofit are losing money. The idea that these people had no idea why they were doing this, the idea that these people had no idea why they were defrauding a nonprofit organization to send across to a political consultant, that is just not a plausible inference in light of the evidence in the record.
Wasn't there an email forwarded by Ms. Nicholas then to Fatah?
Yes.
That seemed to suggest a point in time when there was a bit of friction between Ms. Nicholas and Mr. Brand.
The Bob needs to back off email. In March of 2008, at this point, EAA has sent Solutions $500,000, but Solutions, remember, had to send Mr. Lindenfeld $600,000 because that was the amount of the illegal campaign loan. Mr. Brand starts emailing Ms. Nicholas about sign the contract, send the rest of the money. Ms. Nicholas forwards that email, this is March 2008, forwards that email to Mr. Fatah and says, I have other things going on. Bob needs to back off. Now, as the government argued at trial, there was no other reason for Ms. Nicholas to send that email. There was no reason for Mr. Fatah to have been involved in negotiations between EAA and Solutions over legitimate work done for the benefit bank. The reason, as the government argued at trial and as the evidence showed, the reason Ms. Nicholas is sending that email is because she knows full well and Brand knows full well that all of these multiple acts of wire fraud and obstruction are being committed at Fatah's direction and to benefit him so that the other enterprise members can benefit as well. And as this court said in Bergeron, that is the test of an association in fact enterprise, a common purpose and direction from common leadership. All of that evidence against Mr. Nicholas and Ms. Nicholas and Mr. Brand showed that they were aware of that common purpose and direction from common leadership, and that is sufficient to support their conviction for racketeering conspiracy. It was not necessary for the government to show that Mr. Brand and Ms. Nicholas were specifically aware of the illegal campaign loan. There's no requirement that every member of the conspiracy know the particulars and details of all the schemes. What we did have to show was that Ms. Nicholas and Mr. Brand were aware of their participation in acts of racketeering and their agreement to participate in multiple acts of racketeering to support the larger purposes of the enterprise, the larger purpose of advancing Fatah's career politically manipulated financially through corrupt means to benefit every member of the conspiracy, and that is exactly what this evidence showed. Mr. Brand and Ms. Nicholas also argue that they were not charged in any other scheme, but the schemes were a method by which the government organized the predicate acts of racketeering in this case, but that is not a legally dispositive unit of analysis. There is no case that says you have to be involved in more than one scheme. Scheme is not even a legal term here. The statute does not talk about schemes. It talks about agreement to engage in multiple acts of racketeering activity. And here, for Mr. Brand and Ms. Nicholas, there was not only the agreement, there was their direct performance of multiple acts of racketeering activity. The jury found in its special verdict form that Mr. Brand and Ms. Nicholas committed specific acts, multiple acts of wire fraud and obstruction of justice. And that obstruction of justice continued on for years. To Ms. Nicholas's point about showing the continuity of the enterprise, there was, as the court noted, the repeated filing of the false campaign finance reports, and the jury was specifically instructed that it had to find that there was those were acts of concealment agreed to by the conspirators from the outset. But in addition to those false filings, there were multiple acts of obstruction committed by Brand and Nicholas themselves. There were the fake contracts they created. There were the lies to the Inspector General agents. There were the non-responsive responses to administrative subpoenas. There was the doctoring of the EAA general ledger to hide the last $100,000 payment at the time it was turned over to auditors in September of 2009. Those were multiple acts of obstruction of justice that carried on over a period of years and that were not only agreed to by Brand and Nicholas, they were committed by Brand and Nicholas. Those acts show the continuity required. They show the multiple acts of racketeering activity, and Nicholas and Brand's awareness of their purposes shows that they were aware that this was part of not just an individual act of wire fraud, but a full-on RICO conspiracy.
Just as a point of clarification of the record, is it true, as Ms. Nicholas argues, that there's no evidence in the record that Nicholas knew Lindenfeld, that was simply a misstatement at the district court?
Yes, I believe that is correct. Mr. Lindenfeld testified that he knew the other members of the conspiracy. I believe he did not testify that he knew Ms. Nicholas specifically. Of course, the government proved Ms. Nicholas's connection to other members of the conspiracy in other ways. There was her status as a former Fatah staff member, the fact that she was the executive director of the Fatah-founded nonprofit. There was her coordination with Brand in the loan repayment scheme. There was her giving some of the money from the fake conference scheme to Mr. Naylor. And then, of course, there was the fact that the last $100,000 that Ms. Nicholas took from EAA to repay solutions for fronting the Lord loan money came from another Fatah-founded nonprofit, Core Philly, and there was testimony that expenditure by Core Philly would have had to have been approved by the chairman of the board, who was at that time Mr. Fatah. So Ms. Nicholas is correct on that narrow question, but the evidence at trial showed in other ways her relationships to other members of the conspiracy, which is of course one of the factors in Boyle for an association in fact enterprise.
What about as to Ms. Nicholas as to the broader purpose in promoting the image, the political image of Congressman Fatah? The government seemed to rely on the fact that others were political operatives, had experience, that the jury could infer their understanding of how the various repayment would be used. But that does not seem to apply to Ms. Nicholas.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the evidence presented here was sufficient about Ms. Nicholas's knowledge of the purposes of the scheme more broadly was sufficient to support the jury's verdict that Ms. Nicholas had agreed to participate in a larger racketeering conspiracy. There was the Bob needs to back off email. There was the $100,000 from Core Philly that would have to have been approved by Fatah. And there was just As I said a moment ago, the sheer implausibility of the contrary inference, the notion that Ms. Nicholas is bilking her own nonprofit organization to the tune of $600,000 and doesn't know why she's doing it when no work is being done for them for the $600,000. All of that was sufficient evidence to support the jury's conclusion that Ms. Nicholas was aware that the acts of wire fraud and obstruction of justice that she was committing in the loan repayment scheme were not isolated acts of fraud, but were intended to benefit Fatah and were coming at his direction. The RICO conspiracy statute does not require, and the case is interpreting it, they do not require that Ms. Nicholas be aware of the illegal campaign loan specifically. She just has to be aware of the larger purposes of the enterprise or the agreement, the conspiracy. She just has to be aware that these acts, these predicate acts of wire fraud and obstruction of justice are being committed to serve some larger common purpose that's alleged in the indictment and proved at trial. And here the evidence showed that Ms. Nicholas would have been aware of that larger purpose based on her connections with Fatah, her communications with Fatah, Fatah's involvement of the scheme, involvement in the scheme, and the sheer implausibility of any contrary inference.
Mr. Kravis, unless my colleagues have other questions on these issues, and I don't want to foreclose those by any means, we probably should turn to the cross-appeal and the issues that Joe, do you want to ask anything else?
No, I want to talk about cross-appeal.
Okay.
Of course, Your Honor. The district court erred in granting the post-trial motions for judgment of acquittal for Biederman and Fatah for the charges of bank fraud and false statements to a financial institution.
Maybe you can clarify something that I couldn't figure out from the record and I don't understand otherwise. When Mr. Toler testified, he talked about Puma being licensed.
Right.
What does that mean?
I believe Mr. Toler was referring to being licensed as a real estate broker, that is, licensed to conduct real estate transactions. I think that is the best reading of that piece of testimony because Mr. Toler testified that in the jurisdictions where CUMA is licensed, the settlement transactions are closed in CUMA's own name. That is, the CUMA.
Yeah, so that's a great question. It leads to, hopefully, a good question. The Pennsylvania prohibits an unlicensed mortgage lender from closing mortgage loans. So doesn't that disqualify CUMA from being a mortgage lending business?
I don't think it does, and the reason I don't think it does is because neither the bank fraud statute nor the false statement statutes requires that CUMA be engaged in the business of mortgage lending at the time the false statement or material misrepresentation is made. That is, what the Federal Criminal Code says is that if you're a mortgage lending business, if it's part of your business somewhere, to finance or refinance mortgages, then you are now a financial institution for purposes of the Federal Criminal Code.
But I don't understand. If you're not a mortgage lending business that is licensed by the state in which the claim or charge is emanating, then how can that satisfy the financial institution requirement?
Well, it is that last part, Your Honor, that I think answers the question, which is that the Federal Criminal Code, the statutes at issue, say that if you are engaged in this business somewhere, then you are a mortgage lending business. And if you're a mortgage lending business, then you're a financial institution.
So it's irrelevant of what state, as long as it's licensed somewhere.
Precisely. As long as you are licensed somewhere and you're actually doing your business that way. So I don't want to overstate the point here. It's not sufficient that CUMA is licensed in these other jurisdictions. We also have the testimony of Mr. Toler that in those jurisdictions, this is actually how CUMA does its business. That CUMA actually draws on lines of credit. It funds the mortgage settlement. It holds the mortgage for a period of time.
How does that differ from what any S&L or savings bank does with a mortgage?
Well, I believe that there are many institutions that operate in this way, and those are mortgage lending businesses for purposes of the Federal Criminal Code.
They place the mortgage, but just about everybody seeks to qualify a mortgage for the secondary market, and then it goes to the side. I mean, I'm trying to differentiate what CUMA has done here from what various other financial institutions I'm familiar with.
Well, I don't think that the court needs to make that differentiation because I think that the legislative history shows that the statute was amended precisely to cover those other institutions that the court mentioned. That is, there are lots of places in one of the Court of Appeals decisions that we cited in our brief mentions companies like Greenpoint and Aurora. There are lots of companies that do business this way, and the code was amended to cover them. And the reason the code was amended to cover them, and this returns to the earlier point of why the entity doesn't have to be acting as a mortgage lending business at the time of this, the false statement, is that these statutes are intended to protect the integrity of particular institutions. That is, the statutes are not intended to regulate particular kinds of transactions. They are intended to protect particular kinds of institutions. And that's why it makes sense to say that these statutes, the bank fraud statute, the false statement statute, that they protect CUMA, even if CUMA is not acting as a mortgage lending business at the time the false statement is made, because the concern here is people defrauding institutions that engage in this kind of conduct generally. It's similar to the way the Supreme Court has recently held that the bank fraud statute does not require an intent to defraud the bank, the way this court has rejected efforts to limit the false statement statute to false statements made in connection with lending transactions.
But doesn't it have to be in the context of the entity, the organization, acting in its capacity as a mortgage lender?
I believe it does not, Your Honor. There's no element of either statute that requires that, and there's nothing in the definition that requires that. The statutes, the fairest reading of the statutes is that if you engage in these kinds of transactions, if you finance mortgages as part of your regular business somewhere in the country, you are a mortgage lending business.
And but that means resume fraud of someone applying for a job with CUMA would constitute bank fraud? Fraud on a financial institution?
In this context, it might, just as frauds committed against a bank do not have to be connected to particular FDIC deposits, even though it is the FDIC deposits that make the bank a financial institution. Any fraud committed against a bank is bank fraud. Any fraud committed against a mortgage lending business is bank fraud.
Do you really think that's what Congress intended, that kind of reach?
It is, because the intent of Congress, and this is what the Supreme Court has said in Shaw and Laughlin, and what this court has said in its cases interpreting Section 1014, is that these statutes were intended to protect the institutions themselves, not to regulate particular kinds of transactions or statements made in the context of particular transactions. It is just the same as if as a contractor who might defraud a bank. Even if the contractor is performing services to the bank that are not connected to FDIC deposits, that is still bank fraud, because the purpose of the statute is to protect the institution as a whole.
If we're looking instead as the basis for liability here to the services that are being rendered, how do we distinguish the agency function here from other agents, an escrow agent, settlement, if the entity that actually has liability, whose funds are the ones on the line, is not the entity that is being designated the mortgage lending organization?
Well, with respect, Your Honor, I think the evidence taken in a light most favorable to the government showed that it is CUMA's funds that are on the line. CUMA is borrowing money to finance these transactions. That means CUMA is on the hook for repaying the
Going back to my earlier question, which is essentially what every financial institution that places mortgages.
Well, they get their funds from someone else. Maybe it's depositors. Maybe it's using transfers from the Fed from day to day. I mean, money can come from anywhere.
With respect, Your Honor, I think when the court says using funds from somewhere else, it depends on what exactly the nature of the transaction is. If the institution is holding funds in escrow for another entity, then that organization probably is not a mortgage lending business, because it's not putting up its own money and it's not actually holding the mortgage that is purchased. In this case, by contrast, CUMA, as Mr. Toler testified, this is what's in the record taken in the light most favorable to government, CUMA is not acting as an escrow agent. They are not holding a credit union's funds in escrow, and they are not then holding the mortgage in escrow. As Mr. Toler testified, we own the mortgage.
Are they flipping open the mortgage right away?
Mr. Toler testified that the length of time varies. He said that it can vary from a couple days, a couple weeks, a couple months. And in particular, he said they flip it to other places. Sometimes
isn't that only true as to the three states? As to other states, including Pennsylvania, that is not true.
That is correct.
And it was not true in the context of the statements that were made here and the release of the funds here.
That's correct, which goes back to the earlier question, that as long as CUMA is doing that, what the statute says is as long as CUMA is doing that somewhere, as long as that is CUMA's business practice.
Say we're not persuaded by that theory, and that what we have here in the context of the statements that were made and the purposes of them, the release of the funds, it was in the context of an entity to which CUMA's members have delegated the responsibility for the origination, for the processing, for the underwriting and closing of the loan.
That's correct.
So given that, how do we distinguish that the agency function there from other agents that are involved in a mortgage lending process?
Well, the distinction would be the other agents who are involved in the mortgage lending process. In order to qualify as a mortgage lending business under the Federal Criminal Code, they have to, as part of their business somewhere, actually put up their own money and own the mortgage, as CUMA does in the District, Maryland, and Virginia.
So if we're not persuaded by that theory, in other words, an agency theory alone is not sufficient, even if the services provided by the agency involve the originating, the underwriting, the processing, and closing of the mortgage loan?
No, that's correct. The agency theory alone is not sufficient. CUMA itself has to actually be a mortgage lending business. The point I was making is just that
we're trying to ascertain what a mortgage lending business is.
Well, the CUMA, in order to be a mortgage lending business, has to put up its own money to finance a mortgage, and then it has to actually hold the mortgage. And Mr. Toler testified that in the District in Maryland and Virginia, that's exactly what CUMA does. In those jurisdictions, CUMA is not an agent of a credit union. CUMA is not an escrow for the credit union. CUMA is doing the transaction itself. It is putting up the money that it gets from drawing on lines of credit, and it is holding the mortgage, and then CUMA is going out and selling the mortgage to get the money to repay the line of credit. That is mortgage lending. You're engaging in the business of financing a mortgage. Financing a debt secured by an interest in real estate is the language of the statute.
But even here, it's getting money from the credit union. It's then financing the mortgage, and then it pays back the credit union.
Right. So an organization like CUMA is taking a loan to get the money. They're using the money to fund the settlement, to pay off the person who is selling the house. Then the organization, are holding the mortgage. They're the owner of the mortgage. And then sometime later, they go and sell off the mortgage and use some or all of the money from the sale, depending on how well they did, to pay back the loan that they took out. That is exactly the kind of institution that Congress was trying to protect when it expanded the reach of the statute to go beyond just banks, just organizations that hold insured deposits. And the reason for that is because this organization is actually funding the transaction. It's not just holding things in escrow. It is borrowing money to actually fund the transaction. And to return to the court's earlier point, there are many institutions that function in this way, and Congress intended to protect those institutions when it amended the statute to include this definition.
Just so I'm clear, and I think Judge Greenaway's question goes to this, you're speaking again about the way the transaction takes place in the three states where CUMA is authorized to act in that way.
Right.
In the 48 other states, including the state in question here,
right.
is it correct, from Mr. Toler's testimony what's presented in the record, that CUMA at no time has its own funds on the line in the mortgage, in making a mortgage loan?
I don't think that's quite correct. What Mr. Toler said was that in those other jurisdictions, the transactions are not closed in CUMA's name because CUMA is not a licensed real estate broker in those other jurisdictions.
But the loan isn't in their name. Their name isn't on any of the papers. But even the funds, if we think financing is a funding, the drawing down there is on a line of credit belonging to the CUMA member. Right, Patman here.
What Mr. Toler testified to is that the financial aspects of the transaction are identical in all jurisdictions. Cuba is drawing on a line of credit. It is putting up the money at the settlement. It is holding the mortgage, and then it is eventually selling the mortgage and repaying the loan. Mr. Toler testified that the only difference is whose name appears on the documents at the closing, because outside of the District, Maryland, and Virginia, Cuba is not licensed, was his testimony. But as Mr. Toler testified, in all other respects, the financial transaction is the same.
Thank you. We have you back on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Craven. Counsel, this court never puts out the hook, but we'll hew a little more closely to the clock on rebuttal. Mr. Nager.
Thank you, Chief Judge Smith. May it please the court. On the harmless error issue, the government has tried to defend its argument that there was harmless error here on an alternative theory of guilt argument. But in fact, there was no alternative theory in this case. There's a single bribery count, a single set of instructions about what constitutes bribery, and as Judge Smith pointed out, the indictment and the government's evidence is there were three kinds of official acts that formed part of the alleged pattern from which corrupt intent could allegedly be inferred. They're trying to unlink the official acts that they actually tried the case on as being linked together to cumulatively give rise to the inference of intent that they're trying to, again, unlink the intent from the official acts. Well, you can't unlink the official acts and you can't unlink the intent from the alleged official acts, because that's the way the case was instructed to the jury. To say it less abstractly and more concretely, if the jury believed that the Kirk meeting was an official act and that there was an exchange there, it makes it more likely that the jury would find, perhaps, that the ambassador acts were official acts and that there was an exchange there, or to his alternative theory of guilt, if the jury finds that either the Kirk meeting or the ambassador acts are official acts from which a corrupt exchange could be inferred, it makes it more likely that they'll find that there's a corrupt exchange on the $18,000 payment and perhaps the Zion's hiring, although the jury was never asked to do it that way, because as he said, it was tried on a these for those, not a this for that theory.
But in reviewing for harmless error, if we conclude that no reasonable jury could conclude other than that the hiring of Ms. Zions was an official act, if, say, that were conceded, and if our harmless error inquiry is limited to the official act element of the official act piece of bribery, then why isn't that dispositive? Why doesn't that
Because the jury has to find a corrupt exchange between whatever the official act is and whatever the alleged favor is. And here they were instructed, the way you find or don't find, depending upon what you conclude the evidence shows, is from a pattern, from the cumulative impact of all of the alleged official acts.
But I think
the jury was never instructed.
The point is that with money laundering, the money laundering convictions showed that the jury found a link.
No.
A link between the payment and hiring. The hiring is an official act. Why isn't that the end?
With all due respect, the jury, there's nothing in the jury verdict that says it found a specific link between the $18,000 and the hiring. It found that the $18,000 was money laundered from a bribery scheme. It found that Bowser was part of a bribery conspiracy that started allegedly in 2007 and went through 2012. There's nothing in either of the two counts that the government is pointing to that tells us that the jury found a link between the $18,000 and the Zions hiring. That's their argument in post-trial motions and here, when below they were arguing that you find the link from the pattern.
Let's hear your response to
on the Kuma issue. First of all, on the what does the statute mean issue, I just point Judge Krause and the panel to the Fifth Circuit decision in the Duvall case, which says there does need to be a nexus between the lending transaction and the alleged fraud. On the argument about whether or not Kuma is ever engaging in financing or refinancing, Chief Judge Smith, what Mr. Toler testified to is that Kuma doesn't have the money to fund those loans. What he testified to is it was a service organization, and what he testified to is we get the money from our members who are our customers, and we take that money and we give it to the settlement attorney in all of the states. So just as the government's counsel has acknowledged, the only thing that differs in the three states from the other 48 states is that they went and got a license so they could actually close the deal in their name as an agent on behalf of their customer member credit unions. There's no testimony in the record to support the statements that are repeatedly being made here that Kuma borrows the money. There's no testimony that Kuma pays interest.
At the closing, when the closing actually happens, right, there's the exchange, right then, isn't Kuma on the hook for the money?
No. No, as he said, the only thing that happens is they are allowed to be not have the member
so
present and sign the paperwork.
Your adversary's statement that they hold the mortgage for some period of time before it's presented to the secondary mortgage, you know, and then they sell into the secondary market, that's not correct.
You're right, Judge.
Who's listed as the mortgagee in the mortgage?
I'm sorry.
Who is listed as the mortgagee in the mortgage document?
In those three states, they can have it done in their name, but the financing in all 51 jurisdictions comes from the credit union, not from Kuma. And if the, for example, if the money is, if the if money is, if the mortgage is sold in the secondary market and you don't get enough back, the only, the it's not like Kuma has to make up the difference to the member credit union. There's no testimony whatsoever in this record from which a reasonable fact finder could find beyond a reasonable doubt that Kuma's on the fact that you guys, pardon my language, the fact that the members of the court.
I'm not offended, but Judge Krause might.
I
stand with my sister. I'm offended.
my inappropriate casual comment was not meant in a gender-related way at all. There's no testimony in the record to support the proposition that Kuma's on the hook for anything.
Why does that matter? You're asking us to equate financing with funding, but when we're talking about the context of mortgage lending and an amendment that was directed toward ensuring the financial stability of mortgage lending institutions, isn't the real concern that entity which engages in the originating and the underwriting of a loan, and if false statements are being made there, that's exactly where the risk is to the integrity of the institution.
You're exactly right, but as both Kuma witnesses testified, the underwriters of these loans are the member credit unions, not Kuma. The Kuma is only a service organization doing administrative processing. In the three states where it's got license, as part of its administrative process,
they're more than a mortgage servicer,
right? No.
Mr. Toler's testimony is that we exclusively provide First Trust residential mortgage loaning services all the way from the origination of the mortgage loan through processing, underwriting, closing, and access to the secondary market.
Right, but he testifies that the money for that underwriting is coming from the member credit unions. He never says it becomes our money.
But the underwriting is a service they provide.
I don't think the entirety of that testimony is that the money is, he says explicitly, we don't have the money to fund these mortgages. That money is coming from our member credit unions.
And as somebody who's for many years been married to a banker, I can say unequivocally that no financial institution other than its capital structure has the money to lend. It always comes from somewhere else.
Well, that's true, but someone owns that money. And there's no testimony in this record to suggest that Kuma ever owns the money.
But if Kuma takes the mortgage, has the mortgage, and goes and sells it on the secondary market, they must have something at some point in time.
No, they're doing it as an agent for their members. That's part of the services that they provide. They can provide more services in those three states where they're licensed to do more things, but they're doing it as an agent for their principal, the member. But let me conclude by saying, if I might...
Why wasn't there an objection to the jury being instructed on the mortgage lending theory? This went to the jury with that theory intact, even if it was a strategy change midway through trial.
I wasn't trial counsel, so I can't actually answer your question directly as to why an objection wasn't made. What I can tell you is the instruction correctly states the language of the statute, defining a mortgage lender as the entity that finances or refinances debt secured by an interest in real estate. CUMA is not the entity that is financing or refinancing this debt. That is its member credit union. It is the agent for the entity that is financing or refinancing. And we know in this particular instance, obviously, as your questions and Judge Greenaway's questions pointed out, in this state, in Pennsylvania, with this one, it would have been unlawful for CUMA to do that because it wasn't licensed. So let me conclude. I realize my light's on. You want to stick to it. Judge Bartle held that 4 of the 8 verdicts here were not supported by sufficient evidence. The verdicts that are before this court are based upon instructions that are deficient under McDonnell. And I do want to just remind the court about our prejudicial spillover and the exclusion of the exculpatory evidence. The reliability of a jury verdict and the liberty of this man is at issue. And the jury system is great, but it depends upon exculpatory evidence being put before the jury, and it depends upon prejudicial evidence being kept away from the jury and proper instructions being given to the jury so it can evaluate innocence or guilt, and none of that happened here.
Thank you, Mr. Nager. Mr. Marinsky.
I will be very brief, Your Honor. I just wanted to, if possible, make 3 brief points about the Juror 12 issue. First, in terms of this dispute about what the district court's credibility findings really went to, I would point the court in the joint appendix in the record to page 5994, that's 5994, where, as far as I can tell, is the only place contemporaneously on the record that the court said something about credibility, and it's just a couple sentences, so I'll just read it. It says, I find my deputy clerk, I'll leave out the names, to be credible. I find juror number 12 not to be credible. I find that he did tell my deputy clerk that he was going to hang this jury no matter what. And that's really not an issue here. As I said before in my principal argument, we've never disputed that that's what he said. The question here is the context in which he said it, and I think the context in which he said it is one that's undisputed. He was frustrated. He was defensive because of how he was being treated, the accusations that were being leveled at him, being questioned by the trial court, and so forth. And that's the context. In terms of what he remembered, again, I think when you look at the record, what he said he remembered when he was initially asked about it, whatever, roughly 20 hours later the next day, was accurate. It was consistent with what the deputy clerk said. It was not until he was asked directly, did you say you would hang the jury? And he said, I did. And he said it twice. And so what he said is entirely consistent with what the deputy clerk said. And the final point I would want to make is that there's no support for the argument that the government makes that there is somehow a lower standard when the evidence that the trial court's relying on to discharge a juror comes from that juror's own mouth. There's absolutely no support for that in the case law. If you could just look back to sort of the leading case, the first case sort of in this progression, and that's the Brown decision, where the juror who was dismissed, and the court eventually reversed, but the juror who was dismissed admitted that he didn't support the law in question, and that if he had known that the law said what it did, that he would not have said he could be fair. And yet he was dismissed, and then the Court of Appeals said that that was error. Those words came right from his own mouth. And so there's no support for the idea that somehow the high standard that this court has applied in Canada and that other courts have applied doesn't apply here. Are there any further questions?
Thank you very much, Mr. Ernst. Ms. Flannery.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I may first, just not to reopen or re-argue a point I made before, but just to make my position clear, because on reflection I may have misspoken or been unclear. This has to do with the juror questioning issue. And my position is that in the context of this case and these facts, it was an abuse of discretion to launch immediately into questioning. And no new rule need be created or inferred in order to reach the result that reversal is appropriate in this case, because that questioning impermissibly compromised our client's Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights. With respect to the RICO issue, I'd like to emphasize the difference between proof of knowing participation in a racketeering enterprise versus proof of participation in a predicate act or a predicate scheme. The Supreme Court has made that distinction in Boyle. This Court has made that distinction in Riccobini and Pungitore. And all the evidence, to the extent that Mr. Kravis pointed to evidence, all the evidence went to was a scheme to defraud EAA in 2008. No more. And I emphasize 2008 because of our count two argument that scheme, as charged as a wire fraud scheme in count two, was outside the statute of limitations, because the only thing bringing it into the statute of limitations was the filing of the CFRs, which were outside reasons, for reasons we developed in our brief, and I won't go into, were well outside the scope of Ms. Nicholas's conspiratorial agreement or knowledge. But all the evidence that Mr. Kravis points to might suggest that Fatah had some involvement in the diversion of the money from EAA to Solutions. It might even suggest that she knew there was something suspicious about this set of facts, that there was a suspicious purpose. But generalized knowledge of bad purpose is never sufficient to prove conspiratorial agreement, and particularly in the context here of a racketeering enterprise, an association by fact enterprise, where Salinas tells us that proof that the conspirators had the same criminal objective is essential to finding that they agreed to participate in the enterprise. And in fact, Boyle tells us that part of what defines the enterprise in an association in fact situation is knowledge and agreement to the purpose.
Your time is up, Ms. Flannery. Briefly.
Well, I'll just point your honors to our brief. There is, it requires so many leaps of speculation to conclude that Ms. Nicholas knew, A, that there was a loan, or B, that it was really Fatah's loan instead of Lindenfeld's loan, or that it had been used a year and a half before for a political purpose. Those are leaps of speculation that must be made to find that Ms. Nicholas agreed to the purpose of the RICO enterprise. And her conviction, as this court has found in many contexts, cannot be affirmed on the basis of speculation.
Thank you, Ms. Flannery. Mr. Gross.
Thank you, Your Honors. As we said before, we are not disputing his involvement in the diversion scheme. And we do agree that the defendants do not have to know the details of each scheme to be involved in a RICO conspiracy. But there must be some knowledge, more than that there's shadowy details, as in Cates. Here, the evidence cited is all count two. And we fully brief that in our briefs and our response. There was no evidence of any of Brand's involvement in the enterprise, as it requires more than the involvement in the fraud in count two, the fraud that was stated. There's no evidence of agreement. This is not a Riccobini situation. This is not as the Brand. There's not a Boyle situation. It's not Turquette, where it's clear from those facts and from the individuals who were convicted there that they all had to know, and that they all were part of it, and there was knowledge and there was involvement by the facts themselves. Here, there's no question that there's one fraud. But there is no evidence. There was no evidence produced by the government that he was in, that he bought into the purpose and that he was involved and he had full knowledge, but more so that he agreed to be part of the RICO enterprise, to be part of that. The government never presented legally sufficient evidence that he was part of a larger enterprise or even knew of the larger enterprise, or that he agreed to participate in the goals of the enterprise. And this destroys his racketeering conviction. Count 2 would also necessarily fail because the discrete acts for which he was found liable fall outside the statute of limitations, the five-year statute of limitations in Count 2. And any acts that Brand was convicted of clearly were outside and way beyond the five-year limitation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gross. Mr. Kratos, rebuttal on the cross-appeal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to make one point here, which is that Mr. Biederman keeps saying there's no evidence in the record that Cuomo was anything other than an agent of the credit unions, but that's not the case. At page 4,239 of the joint appendix, there's Mr. Toler's testimony that Cuomo draws on a line of credit and then holds the mortgage for a short period of time. That testimony, taken in a light most favorable to the government, establishes that Cuomo is the one that's actually financing the transaction. Now, Mr. Biederman made the second point that that's not the transaction in this case was closed in the name of the credit union because Cuomo is not licensed in Pennsylvania. But I think the analogy to the bank fraud statute is apt here. A bank's balance sheet will show all kinds of things, capital, earnings, deposits, etc. The government is never required to trace a fraud to a bank back to FDIC-insured funds, even though it's the FDIC-insured funds that make the bank a financial institution. Similarly here, the government is not required to trace the false statement or the fraud back to the operation of the mortgage lending business in those other jurisdictions, even though it is the operation as a mortgage lending business in the other jurisdictions that makes Cuomo a financial institution. And the reason is the same in both contexts. It's because these statutes are intended to protect particular institutions and the integrity of those particular institutions in all regards with respect to their finances, not just with respect to the things that meet the statutory definition.
Why wasn't Wright Patent charged as you named as the mortgage lender here? I mean, aren't we having this debate because there was a misunderstanding that was cleared up at trial about whether Cuomo was or was not federally funded?
I don't think that's quite right, Your Honor. I mean, the reason that Cuomo was charged here as the victim in these two charges is because the false statements and the misrepresentations were made directly to Cuomo. They were made to the Cuomo loan processor, Victoria Souza, not to Wright Patman. Now, the government could have pursued an alternative charge in the indictment that Cuomo was acting as an agent for Wright Patman in those transactions, but even if there would have been an alternative way to charge the case, the fact that Cuomo meets the mortgage lending business definition makes them an appropriate victim of those charges as well. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kravis. Thank you to all of counsel for well-written briefs, for well-organized oral argument here today. We would like to have the argument transcribed for our purposes. Mr. Zeisman, I'm completely overwhelmed by your reticence today. We're not accustomed to that. Don't make it a habit. We thank all of counsel for the excellent job in what is an important case with numerous very important issues. So we'll take the matter under advisement, ask the clerk to adjourn the proceedings.
Please rise. This court stands adjourned until tomorrow, Friday, January 19th at 9 a.m. Thank you.